the OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
7:30 on this Thursday morning. You're very welcome along to OTB AM. We're with you right the way through until 9:30 this morning. You can tweet us at Off The Ball if you want to get in touch. What are you doing during this coronavirus lockdown at the moment? It's Owen here in studio at the moment. Jer is WFH. That's what the kids say, Jer. You're very welcome.
I don't know what that means. What does that mean?
Working from home.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I had some sniffles yesterday and was like, okay, I just want to make sure that I'm not going to infect everybody. It turns out I just have a cold and I'll be back in tomorrow to spread my cold around the office and make sure that, you know, anybody who's left there will pick it up off me.
I've got addicted to looking at people's working from home setups over the last couple of days. Everybody's tweeting about it. Everybody's showing their own setup. There's something unbelievably satisfying about seeing a good working from home setup. My one at home is ridiculously cluttered and I can't get the same sense of enjoyment. Yours looks pretty good.
It's grand. The Wi-Fi was so bad that I'm now on 4G and I'm much more confident in the 4G working than the Wi-Fi, which doesn't seem to make any sense. I just did a test on my laptop there and it's not great, you know, for it being 2020. And I had to borrow a table from my sister. She had to leave it outside her house. I had to go around, pick it up, not speak to her properly. And also I have like three kids who are about to wake up when they hear the sound of my voice. We're going to burst in and be like, wow, what's going on here? Show me this. I want to be on. So
well, the whole BBC News thing, that's been done and replicated and done and done and done again over the last few years. So they really need to do something extraordinary to even make a mark on our lives this morning.
Exactly. It's passé. It's cliché at this point. What are we, like, day two of this thing and everybody's already done it. So what day is it? I mean, what's ground zero day for this? When did this start?
Oh, good question. I don't know. Even when it comes to today's day, I'm not quite sure. I said Thursday at the top of the show, I'm only 80% sure that today is in fact Thursday.
Yeah. It's
just like an accelerated version of Christmas where people who are lucky to be around loved ones are probably now sick of them. And also, we just have this confusion of what day it actually is. So strange. But 4G, that's great. So what are we, 7:33? It's going to be just Owen with you for the duration of the morning because that 4G will inevitably give up. There's tons to get into here. I say tons relatively speaking. There's actually a few stories that have kind of been keeping us going over the last couple of days. Padraig Harrington has been speaking to Off The Ball during chatting about the Ryder Cup. Hopes it goes ahead this year safely. And if it has to be done behind closed doors, no fans in the golf course, then so be it. But it's interesting, we were just chatting about what he's been saying about coping with adversity. It's something that he was also speaking about on the show last night. He's been saying stuff like, definitely talk to people, getting it off your chest is definitely a good thing when I'm stressed, like talking about limiting social media, watching one news program or reading Twitter for 20 minutes is probably enough. Do whatever you can with your family and get away from it. Like, this is the sort of messages that are kind of important to be coming through from sports people at the moment, not just updates on where their sports are at.
Yeah, like I'm always in two minds about this. Should people be as informed as they can be and be widening from as many sources as they possibly can? I would argue yes, that like knowing what's going to happen will make what happens when it happens a bit more normal. Like when we see, or also give us a bit of hope if we're actually outperforming what was expected. Like for example, the number of cases yesterday was lower than the 30% increase than we had been modelling off and that the models had been where you're going to get to your 15,000 Ireland cases. So is it better that people know that? And they're like, actually, you know what? Some of the interventions that we're doing seem to be having an impact. Now, it's very early on, all that's caveated. But like, if stuff is having an impact, then is the mental health of the nation going to be like, oh, hang on a second, you know, actually, if we do all work together and we do all continue washing our hands and if we do all maintain our social distancing, that actually that's going to have an impact. Would you rather that than blissful ignorance? I would probably prefer that everybody was as informed as they possibly can be. But that doesn't mean sitting endlessly scrolling, because certainly for the first 3 or 4 days of this, I was like on the phone going, oh, Jesus, oh, Jesus, oh, oh, Jesus. And that's not good for anybody either.
No, it's not. But like, is that what your reaction actually is? Is it not just a sense of afterwards, after you put away the phone and then an hour after it all kind of sinks in, you're like, I've consumed a lot of coronavirus content today. I have seen a lot of grim figures from all around the world, from all around the continent, and now it's all kind of sinking in. I think, thankfully, especially when it comes to local news at the moment, we're still scrolling through things and it's only getting worse at this point. It hasn't got to the point of we haven't reached an Adir yet. It's going to happen, unfortunately, and at that point, when you start scrolling through your Twitter feed, when it comes to local news, it's going to be horrendous. But right now, it's kind of like this warning, this shadow in the foreground that is coming our way. And I don't know, there's something about it that kind of just sinks in after a little while when you put your phone away and when you're having conversation and it's just there in the back of your mind. I don't know, it's not a healthy way to be. But I'd be with you on the being as informed as possible, because, as you say, if there is a slightly positive figure or better than our estimations figure, then it's going to cause a little bit of hope. It's going to actually give a bit of an upturn in the mood, you would suspect.
Yeah, and look, I don't know how important that is, because ultimately, as we all know, the worst is still to come of this, and if the worst is as bad, or like if the, you know, if we're talking about a margin of a couple of percent here or there, it's still an absolutely devastating impact on people's lives and where we go to in the future. So look, we're all groping around in this to try and find some way of dealing with it, and Harrington's, you know, like, spend 20 minutes on social media, watch one news program is as good advice as I've seen from anybody. Mm. And also the bit about talking to people, that is hugely important.
As I said, there's a bit happening this morning in terms of the World Sports Administration trying to plan for what happens over the next few months. At the Premier League, they're going to hold a video call today with clubs to discuss their next steps in adapting to the coronavirus pandemic. So completing the season, they say, is a priority, but this won't happen until at least June. So, of course, the Euros have been pushed back to Euro 2021. That will possibly free up some calendar space this summer to actually finish the season. Cancelling the season, ending the season now and awarding Liverpool the title and playing matches behind closed doors are other options believed to be on the table. Around 10:30, I think, this morning, the Premier League clubs are on that video call. Meanwhile, in the GAA, they're meeting to discuss how their calendar is going to be altered. Connacht Senior Football Championship match between New York and Galway, that's been postponed. That was set for the Bronx on May the 3rd. That will not be happening then. Horse racing will continue in Ireland behind closed doors. It's one of the big stories across the newspapers this morning. The industry, though, is going to follow strict government protocols around social distancing and sanitisation. No overseas runners will be permitted, and the policy will come under a daily review. There's going to be no clashes. There's going to be one meeting a day to lessen the burden on the emergency services as well. As we mentioned at the top there, European Ryder Cup captain Padraig Harrington says that as things stand, the matches between Europe and the USA in September are going to go ahead right now, like every sporting event that is subject to change. And finally, very sad news, a snooker legend, Willie Thorne, has announced he's battling leukemia. The 66-year-old broke the news on his Twitter account yesterday and will receive treatment in Spain. Let's tell you what's coming up this morning on OTB AM. As I say, we're with you until 9:30. The sports page is coming your way in just a moment. Phil Egan will be with us after 8:00 to chat through that meeting with Premier League chiefs this morning and to chat a bit more about football. Irish in the AFL then will be coming your way at 8:20. Nicholas Walsh is on the ground over there. The season set to start in an hour's time, remarkably, behind closed doors. The sports news coming your way at 8:35, and then the Classic Game Club at 8:45 this morning. It is Celtic against Rangers. It is from August 2000. It is that famous 6-2 game. So Stephen Doyle and Enda Call will be with myself. We've been watching that back over the last couple of days. So that's coming your way at around 8:45. Before all that, it is time for the back pages. OTB AM. Let's start with offtheball.com. Padraig Harrington leading the way this morning. Harrington would back safe Ryder Cup behind closed doors. In fairness, it does seem to be in that spot at the moment where you can possibly make a case for sport to have resumed at that point. There's not the Olympic level of stress with regards to qualifiers or building up to the event, same as was the case with the Euros in terms of getting playoffs played. So it is a standalone thing. It is at the end of the summer, so there is a possibility. So he's backing a safe Ryder Cup behind closed doors. Kieran Bradley there has written, reasons to be positive about the battle against coronavirus. Manchester United legends open hotel doors to NHS staff. You do wear a tie the day Brian Clough taught Clive Tilsley a fashion lesson. And Football Manager 2020, how to play for free. Yes, you read that right. Jerry, you're gonna indulge in your beautiful home office there, a little bit of Football Manager 2020?
No, this might be the worst thing that's happened to anybody who is actually trying to work from home. The fact that Football Manager is now free, because we know how addictive this thing is. It's crack cocaine, basically, for people who are interested in football.
You've never been into it.
It panders to, for a little while, and a previous version, but it panders to the worst excesses of the male ego essentially is like, oh yeah, I can take this crap team and turn them into five times European champions, and I can buy and sell players like a slave owner. It's like, it's the worst part of, like, I get football theory, I get to become a business person, I was no good at actual football, and here I am king of the world. And yeah, so, you know, obviously Nathan Murphy very good at it. I mean, QED.
Well, the thing is, you're not even good at football in this fake life. You're just good at picking a football team. So, like, it's not like FIFA, who at least I can say, well, I've actually got skills. To be fair, to go back to my Olympics London 2012 video game, it's not as sad as me being excellent at weightlifting on the Xbox, like thinking I'm the strongest man in the world, but on the Xbox. That was probably not as sad as that. I would definitely say Football Manager is less sad.
Was the weightlifting down to your finger ability?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Yeah, and I'm proud of that. Like,
hey, look.
Not everybody can have those skills. The Irish Independent this morning is leading with the League of Ireland. June deadline for LOI return or season may be written off. Dan McDonald reporting this morning that the League of Ireland will resume by June, or clubs will have to consider scrapping the current campaign and starting afresh with a new campaign that would run through the winter, which would be an interesting thing. I wonder, would it be something that they might keep up for future seasons, to actually go back to playing the season over the winter? Players open to summer finale, meanwhile. Rory O'Connor saying that Ireland's players would be willing to play deep into the summer if it meant finishing the 2019-20 season. This is according to Simon Keogh, Rugby Players Ireland chief. So interesting to see what happens there with regards to the rugby season. Best case scenario is rescue some element of the 2019-20 season, is what he says. You've got Conan Byrne there pictured on the back of the Irish Independent after walking the distance for the Irish Cancer Society yesterday. And that story, once again, about horse racing Ireland. Irish racing will continue behind closed doors, writes Michael Verney.
Onto the Examiner this morning, and here the back page story is an interview with Owen Cadogan. The script's been torn up. No one's ever experienced anything like this. Cork dual player Owen Cadogan has reiterated the message to follow the advice of medical professionals. He's talking about how our life has changed ultimately into the future. The simplest thing in the world, just shaking hands, is something that we all crave now. If you think about a game, the simple act of shaking hands with your opponent beforehand, gone. Never mind just pitting yourself against another player. And he's talking about mental health issues as well. So this was a bunch of GPA and WGPA pushed out stuff on social media, and I know Super Value did with their GA ambassadors as well. He's saying normally this time of year you're talking about the switch to the club championship probably, and who to look out for, who's going well. That's so irrelevant now, so far down the pecking order, that it's not even funny. And then there's a piece by Sean Kelly as well, which is pretty interesting, about what might happen in the championship this summer. It's a knockout throwback championship may be needed. So, like, if we could play for an 8-week period at some point before the end of the year, what's the most important thing to play? Would inter-county matches, straight knockout, old school championship matches on a Saturday and Sunday, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, would that be the worst thing if there was like a little festival of GAA at the end of the season?
No, absolutely not. I think Sarah Farrell's been calling for something similar as well in the Irish Independent this morning, that there is this, I guess, hope that if you get it played, just go back to playing it full knockout. Now, Sean Kelly is actually suggesting throw all 32 teams into the pot and just make it an open draw. And then maybe the first round losers can go into the Talton Cup, for example. You might need to seed it to ensure that you don't have a heavyweight draw in the first round, and that somebody stupid is going into the Talton Cup and will hammer everybody if they lose their first round game. But it's not the worst idea in the world, especially if we're under time constraints. And we all know that it's as good a solution as the provincial championships, which are far more unfair. But then the provincial councils will say they will want to get their provincial finals played and all that sort of thing.
When you think about what Harrington said, the whole point about him saying that he would rather have the tournament go ahead in September behind closed doors than play it next year behind a full audience. Obviously he was saying that after all the health and safety issues have been worked out. The point was that we need a distraction more now than ever. And at some point, hopefully, we're going to start thinking about what that distraction is going to be. And like, if there are sports that can continue, or if there are sports that can get back up sooner rather than later, that would be amazing. Right. Like, is it possible that the NBA, given that teams are so small, and that, you know, you're talking about 10 or 12 people in quarantine and then a skeleton crew to televise it. Is it possible that all those people, given the potential outcomes, could somehow be quarantined away and could travel safely as groups? Like, is it completely ridiculous to think that in a short period of time we could be looking at matches behind closed doors? Because let's face it, we would take anything at this stage.
Yeah, like it's interesting on the NBA thing. Like, one of the issues had been around travel, and I was listening to Bill Simmons make the very valid point that why don't you just let the local television stations run your ABC broadcast or whatever for the night? That way you wouldn't have to take a whole team of broadcasters flying across the country. And like, when it comes to the ABC or ESPN broadcast, that's a lot of people. So just let the local broadcasters do it, put a little local slant on it, let the essential players, and all the players are essential, obviously, so all the players and the essential staff into the building and try and do a very stripped back version of it. I think that would be possible because, as you say, it can be a small enough sport when it comes to personnel. When it comes to the GAA, do we have more hope, and maybe the League of Ireland as well, that it's an Irish competition, that we, once we're back on the right path in this country, this will probably be the first thing to happen? Like, we were kind of having this conversation yesterday that the Euros just seem like such a fanciful notion because it involves so many different countries coming together and being in a safe position. Whereas if we're feeling like we're okay in Ireland and we're okay to have these gatherings, the GAA can probably start before we'll have Premier League back on our screens, I'd imagine. Or yeah, the crowded Premier League. Well, I say that, but like, they're meeting this morning to talk about a potential summer league. So, let's face it, with the money involved in the Premier League, with television money, there's probably more of an incentive for them to get underway first.
Yeah, I do. Like, again, obviously, this is assuming that it's safe to do so. The value of having something for us all to watch and talk about, and even if it is in a stadium that has 150 people in the stadium, because that's the limit, and then you grow. Like, we don't know how this is all going to play out, but you can see the value for the psychic benefits of the country of having something to distract us.
Have you seen the WWE videos in empty arenas?
No. Well, no, what are they like?
We just 100% just watched them back. It's a huge, like, everything is based around the theatre, like a wrestler going up to the crowd and telling the crowd about how they're going to beat up the person in the ring beside them. So they still do that thing, except they're talking to nobody in the arena. So there's like definitely a comic value to it all, which is kind of hilarious. But I think wrestling's actually pressing on.
Have you watched the Marvel race?
Yes, twice. Because I actually kind of forgot what happened the first time. I thought that the green one got... Like, first time I watched it, I was like, well, clearly there's going to be a big twist here. This green marble at the front is obviously going to get beaten. But it doesn't. Was everybody just interested in who finished second? Like, there's not even a twist at the end.
Well, I mean, it's very long. It's about 3.5 minutes. I'm like, hang on a second, what? So I watched to the point where the green marble fell behind, and then in the comments it became clear afterwards that he had actually won. So I was like, well, I'm not going back to that now.
What?
I mean, somebody spoiled it for me. So
I thought the green marble did win.
He does, exactly, yeah.
Oh, sorry, he's been leading from the front for the entire thing, no?
No, he goes behind. There's a bit where, like, he actually falls to third, and so obviously he has some kind of weird comeback victory.
It really was a good story. I need to go back and watch it a third time then. I completely missed that. The Irish Times this morning, leading with the racing. Continuance could strike wrong note with public, writes Brian O'Connor. Coronavirus pandemic has led to a shutdown in action in Britain and France. Harrington expects Ryder Cup to proceed as planned, as we've mentioned, while dissent grows as IOC battle to keep games on track. Many athletes unable to fulfil their usual training regimes and want some clarity, you'd imagine. There needs to be something said to the IOC, to people in Japan at the moment, that this thing is just not likely to go ahead at the moment, because they seem fairly pig-headed and wanted to go ahead. And David Kahn there, as we've mentioned, Premier League to meet with aim of end games in mind. Officials have been modelling different scenarios for getting games back on track. So we'll be interested to see what happens there. 10:30 this morning, a conference call involving all 20 Premier League clubs.
The Guardian is next for us. Again, the IOC story is one of their main stories this morning. And it does feel like there's tension between the athletes and the organisers and the Japanese government at the moment. I have a little bit of sympathy given how big an event the Olympics is. The whole notion of being the person whose job it is to pull the plug and say, this can't happen, that weighs very heavily on, you know, very few people. And also, again, that whole sense of, actually, you know what, things have turned around, we're going to be okay, how amazing it would be to have something to look forward to. So you've got to strike the balance between public safety, the right messaging, and then also, I don't know, it's not panic at this stage. I think everybody is fully aware of exactly how bad this thing is. But when does the Olympics get rescheduled for? Is it a couple of months? It can't be. So it has to be next year. Does that make any sense? Is it still even in Tokyo? Like, what, you know, I can see why it's so difficult for them to get their head around.
Yeah, for sure. Back page of the Irish Daily Star this morning is Cop On, Razor Labels Pool Debate as Irrelevant. Ray Houghton quoted as saying that this thing is irrelevant at the moment compared to the pandemic going around at the world. It is quite irrelevant. Like, he's obviously right. If you compare anything with a pandemic, it is going to come across as irrelevant separately to it. I'm sure that Liverpool winning the Premier League is high up in the priority list of the lives of Liverpool fans right now. As I say, if you start comparing these two things, it's always going to seem like a small deal, but it's going to be an important deal when it eventually happens for Liverpool to them. Connacht Eye, new date. Connacht GAA officials remain hopeful that the game between New York and Galway can be played at a later date this summer. Premier pleads with clubs. Premier League will today plead with its 20 member clubs to finish the season. Racing gets green light, writes Brian Flanagan. And we are playing Jenga. We have got to be very careful we don't turn the whole thing upside down. Liam Griffin has been speaking about the COVID-19 crisis.
The Mirror, I've got the UK Mirror for you here. It's Football United. Abramovich and Neville hand hotels over to NHS workers as sport comes together to battle virus. Football League's 50 million survival fund, so the EFL have stepped in very quickly to put together a fund together of 50 million quid to try and keep those clubs in the lower divisions in English football alive. Prem and EFL, let's get it done. So the plan for football is that they're going to try and get back as soon as they possibly can. Now, it's going to be difficult to see how they will get that through when you consider eventually yesterday the British government decided, okay, it's time to close the schools. And you know, at the stroke of a pen, they were like, we're cancelling GCSEs, we're cancelling A-levels, which was a fairly remarkable quick turnaround. It was like, no, go to school, go to school, go to school, it's fine. It's like, oh yeah, the whole school year is wiped out now. And that obviously has fairly interesting repercussions for university places next year and all that kind of stuff. And more than likely, you would expect that we'll see something fairly similar here. Farrakhan said that they were making contingency plans for the Leaving Cert. It's hard to see what those contingency plans would be. But anyway, it's hard to see how football comes back at any point until further down the road. And then do you knock on into next season? Like, if you can't play until July, what do you do? Do you run next season all the way up to the World Cup in Qatar, which is a Winter World Cup? Like, what are the solutions here? Apart from saying that season is over, Liverpool are the champions, two teams come up, everybody starts again, and away we go.
Well, you would prefer to finish something that you've started, like, rather than actually starting something fresh. So I would have thought that the priority has to be to conclude this season and get next season started at some point. Now, it'll end up kicking the season back. As you say, we might actually end up losing a full season of football at some stage, but it'll roll into the Qatar World Cup. So they're lucky in that regard, FIFA, that this is actually the Qatar World Cup is the next one up, that pushing things back into the winter means that Premier League clubs would actually have a nice break running into the Qatar World Cup. So I think we will lose the season. I think it's very, very hard to get everything played. I think it's the lead up to that 2022 season, isn't it?
In a way, though, like, the Premier League are also in a weird scenario where we know who the best team were. We know who the champions were. So for once, you could actually go, right, we're going to put a pin in this. Next season is going to start late, but we'll get it done. And we, you know, like, there's not that much that needs to be sorted out. If, okay, maybe you have relegation and those clubs, that's the thing you can't do. So maybe you have no relegation. That was one of the suggestions around the Bundesliga. Just promote two teams and have a bigger competition next year. Like, maybe the EFL Cup takes a hiatus so you have some extra match days, or there's definitely a way to have an expanded Premier League for one season if you had to. I know, what, like, why do we need to finish this season? I suppose because we know the champions.
But take it any other year, take it in any other situation, what would you do with the season? If there was still a proper title race, you would finish that thing. And I think that finishing it is more important than starting something afresh. Getting something that you've already started done. If you, like, it goes for anything in life. If you started a task, just finish it before you start something new. And
I don't know. I don't know. You reach a certain point in your life and you're like halfway through a bad book. And it's like, oh, yeah, just finish the book you started. It's bollocks. You stop reading that book and you move on because there's only a certain number of days that you're going to be alive.
See,
don't
I'm
do
on,
it.
I'm
just
in
move
the,
on.
I'm in the finish the book category. I'm in the
yeah, like, but how many crap books have you finished? You're like, oh, that wasn't worth my time.
I say I'm a
tipping point in your life, when you realize there's only so many days left. There's only so many books you're actually going to be able to finish.
I'm a finished
book. Only the good ones.
I'm a finished book guy in principle, but in practice, I rarely am. So, like, I can see that. I can see the temptation for people like you to put the book away and stop. But I want to actually get this done and just see Liverpool win the Premier League properly. Do it with the proper number of games. Football will return eventually. Wait until then. Finish out this season. If it means losing a season, so be it. At least do it right. And
So lose next season. Is that what you mean?
Possibly. Possibly. Or else next season just starts really late. And then that kicks football back into its routine of being in line for the Qatar World Cup. Which, of course, means losing that 2022-23 season, doesn't it? So
exactly, exactly. So, I realise that this is all completely a pointless conversation. However, there's definitely a sense that what we need to do here is, like, understand the scale of this is so big that maybe killing the season is the right thing to do.
You've got a visitor at the door, Ger. Back page of the Irish Mirror is League of Ireland. We should actually get you to open the door and see who it is. Is it MTV Cribs at the door looking
it's
for
the,
you to tour him around?
The postman.
League of Ireland aims for June return, but season may be axed. And Irish racing to gallop on. That is the Irish version of the Mirror this morning. The Irish Sun then today is Care B&B. Abramovich and Neville hand over hotels to help NHS. You've got EFL's £50 million safeguard and Townsend Prem plea. Andros Townsend pleaded with Prem Chiefs for the season to be completed. And there's also a story here which is not coronavirus related. Every pog has its day. United to let him go. It's an exclusive by Neil Custis this morning. Paul Pogba's Manchester United career is over. Despite suggestions that a peace deal is being made, both sides want a splitting of the ways. Offers around £100 million would see United move quickly to get a deal done for a player whose contract is up next summer. They have the option of triggering a one-year extension, but that would be only to protect the value of the French World Cup winner. 27 years old at this point, Paul Pogba.
Postman comes and says, I hope you're not on live now, are you? I'm like, yes, I am. So,
anything good in the post?
Birthday cards for my son. But look,
happy birthday to young Mr. Gilroy.
The post office still continuing in this time of crisis to provide a network of people, like absolute frontline heroes. And like, what with the heroes, you know, don't always wear capes, but like legitimately a heroic part of our society that we probably don't value as much as we, and this is going to be a lesson that we learn, that we need to recalibrate our entire value system. And the people who carry stuff for us, who stock our shelves in shops, who are driving around delivering stuff, unbelievably important at this time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No question about that.
A tangent.
And long way to keep doing it. Hopefully it's a situation that they'll be allowed to keep doing for the next little while. Just a couple of other things just to touch on, Joe, before we move on to something else. This Irish racing story, what's your take on it? Like, just for anybody who's kind of coming to this a little bit fresh, there have been a lot of measures put in place to kind of go further than the behind closed doors aspect of Irish racing here. So there's going to be no double meetings, only one meeting per day. So as I said earlier on, this is not to draw on the emergency services any more than they need to. Jockeys' weights are going to be increased by £2. So that means they can close the racecourse saunas. There's going to be no owners permitted to attend, no overseas runners, and maximum 30 minutes between races to assist social distancing. So basically, this is an industry trying to save itself at the moment.
Yeah, and so there's always two sides to these things where, like Brian O'Connor's piece, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, where he's talking about how the public might respond to this. I think that we all need to be very careful about being outraged about everything at the moment, because tensions are so high that it's very easy to get outraged about, this is awful. But actually, when, you know, if the racing industry needs to survive and to protect thousands and thousands of jobs, then unless the government steps in and says, oh, don't worry, we've got your back, this is exactly the same as every other industry that's desperately trying to scramble around. You know, you see those restaurants who've gone to collect only, and, you know, they're keeping three or four people employed. That's three or four families who have slightly less stress than the other families whose jobs have gone. And so the racing industry, desperately needs to protect those jobs and to make sure that it doesn't disappear. So that's clearly the thinking behind trying to keep it going. If there is a knock-on impact where we all sit around and watch a bit of racing, like, how bad is that? On the other side, they absolutely have to make sure that it's completely safe for everybody to be taking part in it. Like Wayne Rooney's piece last week about footballers being guinea pigs, you know, it would be very easy for somebody to go, oh, I'm not happy about this. And if people aren't happy, they should be allowed and not punished retrospectively or down the line for not taking part in racing. But you do feel that, like, there's a society in racing where the instinct is to look after each other. And I have a real hope that that's actually what's going to happen in this instance, that, you know, they do get their house in order and they can continue for at least a little while to try and keep the industry alive. And I don't know. Okay. Yeah, I can see why people are going to criticize this and go, there's no reason for this to be happening. But again, at the same time, like, you know, people are still going about their working lives. We have to find a way to function where social distancing is the new norm. After this version of coronavirus sweeps through, like, I don't think we're going back to handshakes. I don't think we're going back to sitting cheek by jowl. I think there's going to be a lot more working from home, and there's going to be hand sanitizers everywhere from now on, because COVID-19, what about COVID-20 and COVID-21? And like, what about those next new strains that we don't have vaccines for as well? So, like, this is probably a new normal, and finding ways to work and survive, we just have to do it. So if they are being guinea pigs, then maybe actually we should be grateful for the fact that this is happening, so long as it's safe for them to do so. That's the overriding concern, the safety of everybody involved.
Yeah, and like, I think as well, when it comes to this, this is measures being put in place for now. This is dealing with what the government have already told. This obviously wouldn't be going ahead. No racing would be going ahead, or will it, when the government actually step this thing up to a full lockdown? And we still suspect that this will happen at some point over the next few weeks. Like, this is still very much kind of a last-ditch effort from racing to get a bit of revenue going, to keep a few livelihoods going. And then next week, for example, if the government puts in more restrictive measures, then you suspect that this is obviously just going to go by the wayside, and then there will be kind of a full clampdown on all racing activity.
Yeah, and look, again, that's the bit where it's really important that the messaging from the government is super clear. Like, the bit where they were suddenly asking the restaurants and bars to close, somebody said they don't actually have the power to enforce that. But at the same time, that suddenly gives the industry the ability to turn around to whoever holds their loans and to the workers and say, look, this is actually now a government directive. It's the same with this. Like, you know, if you're a small trainer who is living for getting the horses to run and you don't have racing, or you're being asked to voluntarily stop, like, how do you pay your mortgage? And until the government actually step in and say, okay, well, we're going to stop this now because we've got a plan in place, we've got finances in place, very, very difficult for people to go, yeah, okay, I'm going to turn off my lifeline, the thing that I've spent my entire life trying to build up, this entire business, on the basis of a very, very uncertain future. And there's a couple of other things that are happening at the moment, Owen, that we should talk about. European club football could resume in May, according to Javier Tebas, who is the La Liga chief executive. In mid-May, we should be able to be back on with all European competitions, all of them. Of course, it depends on how the pandemic evolves. This is speaking to Marca, which seems very, very optimistic to be speaking from a country that is in the midst of the worst of their version of the pandemic at the moment in Spain. So it could even be before then, but this is the date that we're working on as a latest in order to start up again. We don't want to change any seasons. We haven't thought about doing that. In this situation, the scenarios we're considering are all short term. If we can't sort out the short term, then unfortunately we aren't going to have time to sort out anything more long term. We aren't allowing that to enter our minds.
That is remarkable optimism.
Yeah, maybe a bit of long term planning, you know, scenario B. I presume this is what he's saying to the media, and actually they have a plan for this entire season to collapse and for next season to start at some point. You have to assume that they do that, because the point you make about, like, European football, how are they going to do this? Can they do it remotely? Can they do it virtually? They can't. They have to fly a team from England to Spain and from Spain Germany, and that's just not going to happen. Like, we just know that that is not going to happen. Flights are going to be grounded at that point. And, you know, for this to be starting again in May, does he mean, like, he's saying middle of May? I mean,
I think that's so, like, when you look at everything that's happened in Spain in particular, even if you take La Liga, even if just their own domestic league by May, I think that's an unbelievably optimistic view. Like, it's, I guess, though, if you are running a football league and you have said football is suspended until X date, X date is always going to be April at this point. So maybe you do have to actually give that message to say we actually fully believe in what we're doing right now, and maybe it allows teams to perhaps go back out training. Like, that even just seems weird at this point that someone would suggest that. Like, it just seems far more safer at this point for a league organisation to actually say, well, actually, we're going to write this off until the middle to the end of the summer, and that way you don't need to worry about training. Like, it's something that, like, I saw the Kerry County Board come out and say recently, yesterday, that there will be a period, after the fixtures are announced, there will be a period then of grace for you to actually get back up to speed. Like, I think that there is certainly a situation with a lot of teams in a number of different sports where they're unsure of when they will be back, and therefore they're unsure if they should go out and actually train on the football pitch, which is quite dangerous at the moment.
Sorry, that story up on offtheball.com if you want any more details on it. That La Liga story, look, that was the other point. I think they were talking about basketball. Like, do you go straight to playoffs in the NBA and you need warm-up games? And apparently nobody, they don't like exhibition games when it comes to that kind of stuff. But that was the point that a lot of the athletes are making. So I think Sebastian Coe, who is obviously, you know, noted for his adherence to all things fair and just and true, was talking about how it would be actually unfair for an Italian distance runner, for example, who's in lockdown to be asked to go and train versus athletes from other parts of the world. And look, it's a fair point Sebastian Coe makes. What a world we live in where we're saying that.
Absolutely. It is 7 minutes past eight on this Thursday morning. Plenty coming up over the next hour on OTB AM. So we're going to hear about football with Phil Egan in just a moment and how the sport is surviving. Crossing over to Melbourne to chat to Nicholas Walsh about the AFL going ahead. The latest episode of the Classic Game Club is coming your way at 8:45. So there's all of that and much more, but we're hearing from Padraig Harrington right after these.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
This is OTB Sports Radio, Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
I was talking to somebody about Messi and hasn't won a major. Then Ronaldo might. Does that make him a better player? Well, Messi hasn't an opportunity to play in the majors, but they're both great players.
The best analysis of all the week's football from Ireland's number one football man.
PSG, I thought professionally, were dreadful. Liverpool had that. Liverpool had an honesty about them that PSG didn't have and deserved to win it. It would have been a disgrace, I think, had they not won that particular game.
John Giles, every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app.
Here at Off the Ball, we want to help flatten the curve. We want to slow the spread. Make sure to wash your hands for at least 20 seconds. Here's today's song to help. Remember, avoid touching your face, cough or sneeze into your elbow, and protect those most vulnerable. Stay safe from all at Off the Ball.
OTB AM.
I'd be more considered, like, wouldn't we love some sport to be going on now? You know, if it was possible that we could, you know, most people are stuck at home, wouldn't we love something to be able to watch on the TV, a bit of sport? So if you know, I would go down the road if it was possible to play it from a health and safety point of view. You know, wouldn't it be great to put something on television for people to watch? Something of, you know, to bring a bit of something else into the day. You know, by the time we get to, you know, that sort of stage, you know, I'm sure there'll be some sporting events where enough of the athletes are recovered and can go out and compete, maybe behind closed doors. But, you know, I'm not talking golf here. I'm talking other sports. Just to give us something to watch on TV. We all miss the Premiership. We miss talking about. We miss the rugby. We, you know, whether it's golf or any other sport, it would be not essential, but it would be it would sure beat watching another box set on Netflix or something, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I am already at the end of my Netflix at the moment. I'm struggling to fill the time. So yes, I think it would be very, very strange. I mean, particularly with the Ryder Cup of all golfing events. But I'm probably with you.
Yeah, I think it would be odd and strange, and I think some of the soccer matches that went down behind closed doors, there was a bit of that about it. But like, it'd be more providing a service than necessarily about the sport. Mm. You know, that you could see it happening in that sort of situation where as I said, players can be checked, or at this stage, you know, at that stage in September, you wouldn't want it taken away from a limited number of tests that there are now. But by the time of September, assuming there is more ability to test people, maybe some people have recovered, as I said, and there's lots of different things to scenarios by the time September comes around that could come into play that we just cannot envisage right now. And that's why they haven't cancelled it or are preparing to have it, because there really is so many scenarios that could come into play before that crunch time. A lot of these events, there will be a crunch time with sporting events. You know, if you don't pull the plug 2 months or 3 months before, you incur certain costs in terms of the infrastructure that you put up. And obviously for people, even though with the Ryder Cup, obviously there'll be a lot of accommodation already booked and things like that. There's a lot of different scenarios that go into this, but, you know, only time would be the only thing that can tell. I know we're sitting here talking about it, but it really doesn't... we're not going to solve those problems sitting here.
No, we sure aren't. A final, completely irrelevant question then, seeing as you mentioned it earlier on, that you're still hitting a few balls and still practicing to a point. What is your relationship with practice at the moment? Where I presume at some stage it was a searing process to improve and to win and to get better. Has it changed now in the current years?
No, hasn't changed a bit. And it was fascinating there. Somebody... the journalist Brian Keogh tweeted an article that was written, I think, at the Times in 1994 about me winning in the South. I actually retweeted it myself, and if you read the article, it could have been written yesterday, or not yesterday. It certainly could have been written a year ago about how I'm working on things, how I'm changing things, how I started with a new coach, and how I started with a new psychologist. My tune just never changes. That's my personality. I get up in the morning and I think about, well, can I make these things? I go to bed at night thinking about, well, can I make things better tomorrow? And that's the way I am.
Great stuff there with Padraig Harrington. Full piece available on youtube.com/offtheball, who's speaking to Joe Malloy on last night's Off the Ball. Joe, I was just thinking there, if you had all the money in the world, what sporting facility would you install in your house to tick the time away at the moment? Because I was just thinking there, if I was a pretty rich golfer, it wouldn't be the worst situation that you could be. You could distance yourself from everybody and just have a driving range out your backyard. It wouldn't be bad.
I think golf is going to be one of those sports that recovers very quickly from this, because, you know, it's very easy to social distance on a golf course. Like, you know, you go one way, your partner goes another way. Playing two balls, you don't actually, you know, you can shout to each other from across. I kind of feel like over the next couple of weeks, you're going to see a lot of people with a lot of time in their hands going out to golf courses, and, you know, obviously assuming that they all follow social distancing guidelines, and maybe actually that is where they end up. I bought a pudding thing, little pudding machine for the kids from Halpenese. They delivered it
for the kids
24 hours, and an amazing service. I mean, I say for the kids, but at the end of this, I'm not going to be missing from 6 feet, I'm telling you. Nathan was talking about the table tennis table set that you can stick on the tables. Fingers crossed one of those will arrive in the next 24 hours or so from Smith's. So they're the type of sports that I think, you know, indoor sports where the little family unit can play for money.
Any board games yet?
No, not yet. No. We've got a chess set. They're starting to show a little bit of interest in that. So.
Okay.
If by the end of this we can all play chess and haven't killed each other, then that'll be great. I did also, we got a trampoline. We've been putting that off for a long time, and it was kind of like building IKEA furniture. It took a very long time. We were all completely shattered after it, but so far they've all slept very well for the 3 days that we've had a trampoline in the back garden. So
has it been 3 days or has it been 30 days at this point?
Well, and it turns out that I just about squeak under the weight limit for being able to use it myself. So I'm looking forward to also being an expert trampolinist by the end of this. Just on the golf, right? Like,
yeah.
To go back to the point we made earlier about the NBA. So we're talking here about 12 players, essentially. And I know there are vice captains. You don't need to bring the vice captains. 12 players who can all self-isolate in mansions and who can all be flown by private jet to very close to the course. So it's the TV company, obviously, and the quality of the local broadcasters that would that you'd be able to source. But if the TV quality isn't as amazing as we would have come to expect, like, you know that the meme doing the rounds, maybe it wasn't a meme, maybe it was actually somebody's brilliant joke, was our grandparents were all called to go to war. We're being called to sit on the couch. I think we can manage this. At some point, maybe we might think we needed a distraction, and some sports people might be called to go into self-isolation for a fortnight and to completely observe social distancing and to be tested on a regular basis and to go back and play. And that might be their job, is to distract and entertain the masses. Would that really be the worst thing? Like, assuming that it's safe to do so. Let's just put that caveat in. Assuming that it's safe to do so, some people might be asked to go and entertain millions and millions and millions of people.
If that's a legitimate prospect, like, can you shuttle a professional golf player to the first tee at a golf course without him coming in to within 2 meters of another human being? I think there's a possibility you might be able to do
that. They can carry their own bags, or maybe if they can drive their own bag on a trolley, like, I mean, that might be where this whole thing breaks down.
It possibly, like, I don't know, I think there's a lot of things that we don't see behind the scenes, but if there's one sport that perhaps could lead the way in terms of getting back on track, and we're talking in a few months' time, we're talking about around the time of the Ryder Cup now, potentially it is golf. Like, we're talking about playing the Ryder Cup without fans. What about all the guys in their European Union suits? Well, the Ryder Cup just wouldn't be the same without the guys in the European Union suits. So I think we need to actually cool the jets on this, and we need to wait for the Ryder Cup to be allowed to have fans there.
You could have 5 or 6 of them flown in. Like, there could be a lottery across Europe for somebody to get a private jet from their gaff all the way, so long as they wear the same suit for the whole week.
They
document it.
Yeah, they need to be kind of looked after just like the golfers at the moment. Let's have a look at offtheball.com, see the latest stories up there, just to remind you what we're leading with this morning. Dublin duo depart Australia days before AFLW final series commences. Sinead Goldrick, one of the footballers who's gone home. We will hear more on that from Nicholas Walsh in just a moment. European club football could resume in May, the Liga chief Javier Tebas, as we've already mentioned. EFL wants 2020 season to be completed after announcing £50 million relief package. Olympics may not be a level playing field for athletes, says Sebastian Coe, and Le Mans 24-hour race moves to September due to coronavirus. As I said, we will be getting to Australia in just a moment, Gerb. It's incredible, really, that there is live sport about to happen in 20 minutes. The AFL is going to happen in 20 minutes. It's mad. I know that they're not at the level that we're at the moment, but, like, we're hearing, obviously, Irish people being advised to travel home.
What? Where can we watch this? What TV channel is this on? Is it BT?
Ooh, good question, actually. I don't know who's got it. It's Richmond against Carlton at 8:40. So in 20 minutes' time, that game kicks off, throws in, whatever you want to call it.
The NFL are making Game Pass available for free from today for international audiences. The American Game Pass is actually better because you get access to all the historic games. I think, I mean, it's only as far back as 2009, I think. So you can look at all of last season's games, and you can look at the Football Life and previous versions of what's the thing where they go with the team from the start of the season. No, not America's Game. Where they're embedded with the team. Hard Knocks. Hard Knocks.
Oh, sorry.
All the Hard Knocks are available.
Oh.
So Hard Knocks, America's Game, and the Football Life are all up there for free for, I think, the next month at least. So NFL Network for your NFL fixer. It's a crash course in getting into a sport that if they can get back, they will be bringing that back because there's so much money involved.
You could do that, or you could do something even more productive with your time. And this came up on last night's Off the Ball. We had BBC football correspondent Tim Vickery. He's been using the time to learn the finer details of revolutionary Irish politics. So we're just going to hear from Tim Vickery here. Incredible, really, that a South American correspondent, South American football correspondent at the BBC, will be looking into Irish politics. Have a look at this.
And there's plenty of things we can learn. You know, this. I'm not trying to pull one over your eyes now, but what I spent last night, honestly now, learning all about Michael Collins and De Valera, an era of history that I knew very, very little about, but Irish history at exactly that time and how fascinating that was.
Did you really? Why that, Tim?
I found myself. I remember watching the Michael Collins film when it came out in the late '90s,
yeah.
and it was just on TV, and I caught just the end of it, and I was thinking, you know what, that's something I need to learn much, much more about. Mm. I got into all kinds of articles and YouTube documentaries on Collins and De Valera, and just how great Michael Collins looks from hindsight. Yeah. What a colossal human being he was. There was so much more to him than even the film, you know, had in it. There was so many aspects to his greatness. And you, one of those what-if moments, you know, had he survived, what kind of country would your country be now?
That's an interesting question. By the way, this is the one time, literally the one time in our years together where I can correct your pronunciation as opposed to you correcting my pronunciation. So this is actually a joyous moment for me. It's actually De Valera. We call him Dev.
Dev.
He became president as well. He had a long and storied career. There's months ahead, Tim.
Tim Vickery on last night. Joe, we should just constantly call him De Valera.
I mean, I was going to say, I was like, much prefer his pronunciation. He can come and give us lectures in this kind of stuff, and I'd be happy just to listen because of the pronunciations.
Absolutely. It's not even kind of like a situation of our bellies being tickled here. I just find Tim Vickery such a fascinating character and a fascinating speaker anyway. I would listen to him talk to us about anything and educate ourselves on things we already know.
Yeah, well, look, Owen, we have plenty of time to dial up our correspondents in Brazil and elsewhere around the world. So how's life for you guys?
Yeah, absolutely. We are going to be going to Australia very shortly. The AFL is on BT Sport 1 this morning, and we will be speaking to Nicholas Walsh. Joe, like, one of the concerns I have as around the AFL is just the amount of Irish players who are on the periphery of teams. Now, we will get Nicholas's thoughts on this in just a moment. And you wonder, because the games are being played behind closed doors, gate receipts are going to be down, you just kind of fear a little bit for perhaps some of the Irish people involved on the periphery of these Australian teams. I'm not sure if that's a legitimate concern. As I say, we'll find out in a moment. But it probably is something that people down there are thinking about at the moment.
Well, look, you know, the people who are on the peripheries are always going to be the ones who are most harshly dealt with when an economic chill happens. We've seen that in other industries. On the other side, if there are young Irish players available who are on rookie deals, then maybe it's cheaper to keep them than it is to keep some of their colleagues. It's a fairly awful thing to be thinking about at this point, but you've seen already in all of the other sports around the world that with the absence of gate receipts, these teams can't function in the same way. Was it Spurs and somebody else are the ones who who have the biggest proportion of their income still from gate receipts? So playing behind closed doors was not something that they were keen for. Daniel Levy was talking about how this was his biggest challenge as the person who runs Spurs. Like, again, all of this kind of seems like there are minor enough concerns to be thinking about. But sport is continuing, and again, it's going to be very interesting to see what kind of a backlash there is from the Australian public to the fact that this is going ahead, or else they're absolutely delighted. Because, you know, Aussie Rules is the biggest sport there, I think, right?
Yeah, well, look, we can ask that question right now because I'm delighted to say that former Cavan footballer Nicholas Walsh is with us. He's the programme manager for the AFL Coaches Association, working in the area of mental health as well. Nicholas, you're very welcome. Good evening to you, I think. What time is it down there at the moment?
Yeah, it's just coming up to 7:30. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome, Nicholas. Thanks for taking the call. Joe was just mentioning there, this is obviously one of the biggest sports, the biggest sport in Australia. What has the reaction been like to these games in 15 minutes going ahead behind closed doors?
Yeah, it's been an interesting sort of, you know, week or 10 days as such, you know, since probably 10 days ago when the AFLW stuff, the women's code, was basically told they were playing behind closed doors last weekend to where we are now, and the men's just about to, you know, kick off in about 15 minutes time. It's been an interesting week. The AFL came out on basically on St. Patrick's Day, the 17th, and told all the players that it would be a reduced competition from 22 games to 17. There's 18 teams in the competition, so that means that everyone plays each other once. It would be essentially behind closed doors, and it would be under a strict policy in line with the Australian government as well.
What is the reasoning behind that? Is it a situation where there's going to be less games now? Is it less games in a few months? Or where are the games going to be taken away? Because it seems like fairly wishful thinking that they're going to get this whole thing played.
Yeah, I think the way Gil McLaughlin, who's the head of the AFL here, he spoke last night about they don't see it as a 17-week season. They see it as 154 games to be played up until November time if needs be. Normally the season will go to the last weekend in September. But they've already spoken with Cricket Australia and other codes that use all the venues around the country as well. And there will be a little bit of leeway. The MCG, the main venue, may not be available right up until November, but they will have to sort of play that by ear and see how it lies. But I think it all lies in line with the current policy that's here in Australia at the moment. And Australia isn't as bad as Ireland yet, or obviously as bad as mainland Europe. But, you know, it's if you look at the COVID-19 case here, sort of, you know, 3 weeks ago, it was only, you know, less than 100 positive cases, where as of this evening, there's something like 565 and there's cases and there's been six deaths. So it is on the rise, but it's not in that phase at the moment where it's absolutely critical. As opposed to, you know, Italy's and Spain's and places like that. There's 23 million people or so living in Australia. It's obviously a very large continent. It's spread out. But the decision to play Australian rules tonight is one that's been sort of left people in the community feeling a little bit anxious, to be honest.
Yeah, because some measures obviously have been taken. Borders at the moment closed to non-Australian citizens, I understand. As you mentioned, 565 cases, a rise of 111 in the previous 24 hours ahead of your last announcement in Australia. So some measures have been taken. The figures are clearly on the rise, and yet these games are allowed to go on behind closed doors, which kind of chimes in with what Wayne Rooney was saying in the Sunday Times at the weekend, that footballers were being used like guinea pigs in the Premier League, that this idea of games going ahead behind closed doors from a footballer's perspective is actually kind of ridiculous, because what if a player contracts the virus?
And that is one of the key things. And, you know, the big thing and the big talk here is about limiting the interaction that these players have with the outside world. I know, like, I'm involved with a lot of players still, and I know these players have been self-isolating other than going to training. Their training bases have been removed from the norm. Their football departments have been basically uplifted and moved and taken away from everyone else that works in every other football department, whether it's marketing, membership, ticket sales, all that sort of stuff. It's complete separate now. So it's just the 40 odd players and coaching staff and a few peripheral staff. So there's probably only a cohort of around 70 people on any one given day that they interact with.
Right.
So in line with government regulations here, anything under 100 indoors is deemed safe. And anything outdoors under 500 is deemed safe. So that's one of the reasons why the games can go ahead tonight. And I think the chief medical officer from the Australian government played a pivotal role in this yesterday when he met with the AFL commission and board and basically reiterated the case of those numbers around the 100 and the 500 in terms of essential or non-essential gatherings. So that's why there's been a total lockout, but that's why the games are allowed to go ahead.
Because that's one of the interesting things at the moment is with regards to these setups, we sometimes don't know how many people players are in contact with or coaches are in contact with. But from what you're saying there, the AFL have actually come up with a few measures to ensure that the contact time between one individual and the other is limited greatly.
Yeah, correct. And even Gil McLaughlin stated in his press conference yesterday that like the both changing rooms are obviously opposite ends of the ground. They're limiting those well under the 100 mark. I think there's something only on like under 70 because there's only 22 players at any one given time. There one emergency player, which would be 23. You're talking a bit around backroom staff, coaches. You're probably not talking anywhere over 45 people in those changing facilities or changing rooms at any one time. And these changing rooms are a bit like, you know, Crow Park, where there, you know, there's lots of room. There's a warm up area. It's not your old club rooms of Terry Coyle Park or anything like that that you're talking about.
One of the concerns that you would have perhaps is the financial implications of all of this, playing games in front of no fans whatsoever. It's going to affect finances. Is it going to affect the livelihoods of any of our young Irish footballers down in Australia at the moment, those especially on the periphery of these teams?
Yeah, I definitely will. Look, the rough figure that's come out this week is that all players will have to take a 20% pay cut. And obviously the young Irish players, the first and second year players, you know, are only probably on around 80 or 100,000 Aussie dollars, which, you know, is low in comparison to some of the stars that are on nearly $1 million over here. So taking 20% of a pay cut and the cost of living and whatnot, especially in, you know, Sydney and Melbourne, which are, you know, pretty expensive place to live in probably on par with Dublin at the moment. So taking a bit of a pay cut in that regard is pretty heavy. And Eddie Maguire, who's the president of Collingwood Football Club, he's, you know, probably the most famous, if not, you know, he was even chosen as the chef de mission on the international rules a few years ago for Australia. He just came out this evening and he reckons that the industry will could lose up to 500 million Aussie dollars this year, which is a financial downfall. And he reckons that the game could go under. But, you know, hopefully there's a plan B in place as well with all this.
Wow, that's like a fairly stark warning, especially given the popularity of the sport in Australia. Like, if you had to pick one sport in Australia, you might have almost said the AFL is the one that might be most protected from going under.
Yeah, well, look, there's pros and cons, and that's probably one of the reasons why, if once the government deemed it safe to go ahead tonight, that, you know, TV ratings and sponsorship on TV and different things can still be sold. And that's one of the major benefits to, you know, keeping the sport alive. And yes, there will be, you know, some tough times ahead. But I think, you know, just my boss this evening, the Coaches Association CEO, Mark Brayshaw, he's come out and he's taken a pay cut of 20,000, as is all the AFL professional coaches in the game as well. So that's a major win for the association straight away.
The AFLW is still set to go ahead, Nicholas. But at the same time, Niamh McAvoy and Sinead Goldrick have been advised to go home, and I understand they're currently in the air at the moment. But what's the situation there?
Yeah, it's interesting because there was only two rounds to go in the AFLW before finals. So basically the AFL made the decision that, so there's two conferences, there's 16 teams and the two teams or two groups of eight. So they decided in line with the men's fixture that they will give it 3 weeks to play out. This is the estimated time that is going to get, you know, worse in Australia. And essentially they've made now the two conferences have become one. So the two top four sides have been migrated and there's a final series over the next 3 weeks. And I know Melbourne Football Club are very proactive about Niamh and Sinead and they contacted the Irish Embassy in relation to the safety of the players first. And I think it's a very selfless act that what the Melbourne Football Club have done, essentially. And I know other clubs have been in contact as well, but as of tonight, I believe only Sinead and Niamh are the only two that, you know, appear to have left to go back to Ireland, as opposed to the teams that are left in the competition. You know, the other teams like Ash McCarty and the girls that are playing for the Bulldogs, I believe they were getting on a flight sometime this week. But yeah, it's a strange decision. They're into their sort of quarterfinal, I guess it's equivalent of back home. would have been in the semi-final next weekend and a grand final the following weekend if they would have went on. And I think they put like family first, and the club basically said, no, they've done great service. So the embassy basically said they advised them that players should go home. And yeah, they basically got on the plane at 5:30 this evening, Australian time.
Right. It's mad because there's such a situation now where, as you said at the top, you look at the figures and you look at the trajectory Australia is going in, and obviously what's happening here in Europe. When these players touch down here in Europe, there could be a situation where they'll be trapped, and certainly getting back into Australia will prove very, very difficult over the next few weeks and months. Like, it does pose questions over the short-term international recruitment of the AFL and the AFLW at the moment, doesn't it? It seems like an impossible task almost if they want to look outside of the country ahead of next season.
Yeah, definitely. So what the AFL normally do around Easter time is to bring over, you know, 4 or 5 17-18-year-olds to look at bringing into next year's draft. I know they did that last year with the likes of Ross McQuillan and Keane McBride and a few others like that, and young Tui up in the Gold Coast. And so essentially those players won't be obviously brought out this year. They won't be able to have any sort of group interaction through Marty Clark's program back in Ireland with the AFL, and I can't see at this stage any Irish players being identified in time to go into next year's draft if that timing goes ahead. So yeah, you're right, the short-term implication will have its sort of detriment, because, you know, as you know, Irish players are seen as a free pick in a way to some Australian clubs, and what they do is they don't sit in under the salary cap. So it's actually, you know, it sits outside the salary cap. So they can actually have up to 2 Irish players on a list at any one time and keep developing them. So that program will obviously take a bit of a hit, and there'll be, you know, jobs lost through the AFL for that as well.
Nicholas, I just wanted to ask you a question. The way that we've seen this develop across Europe and the world is that the gatherings have gone from nothing over 5,000 to nothing over 1,000 to nothing over 500, and eventually all of the countries so far have ended up cancelling stuff. Is it at the stage where social distancing is actually happening on the streets in Australia? Are people still going to bars and pubs? I guess I'm really asking, is the country taking this seriously just yet?
Yeah, the country is taking it seriously. They're being very proactive. There's a lot of real positive interaction with the government messages, and Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister, he's coming out every second day, you know, as of late, and basically reassuring what's happening is going in the right direction. As you know, the saying is they're trying to smooth out that curve, similar to everywhere in the world. But you know, the message is they are taking it one day at a time, and it's dramatically changing over the course of time. So to answer your question in relation to public spaces and whatnot, there hasn't been full lockdown. There's been recommendations through the working spaces. I know in our working space, we're now split into A, B teams. Half of us are working one day, half of us are working the other day, and alternate days we're working from home. So there isn't full shutdown yet. Schools aren't fully shut down. There is some schools that have opted to basically shut down themselves. There is some cases in some schools, and they opted to close their doors as well. But in terms of public transport, restaurants, different things like that, they are still open. But, you know, numbers are just dwindling. I literally went down to get some takeaway food last night, and essentially there was no one in the restaurant. And on a Wednesday night in Melbourne, there it's normally jam-packed. And the food, you're able to walk in, walk out straight away without, you know, even having to, you know, wait for your food to be ready as such.
Right.
Well, because the Premier League was going to go ahead with games until Mikel Arteta ended up testing positive for coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if any of those AFL players actually have kids and those kids are at school, it's all well and good limiting the people in the building. You just don't know the kids have come in contact with whoever. So how long do you think this is going to continue? It's going to continue indefinitely. Is that the plan at the moment?
Yeah, I think so. What we're hearing, like, through the media and through the different press conferences is that, you know, until there is a positive test in the men's game or the women's game, that's when they will cease for a 2-week period. So what they're trying to do before this spread gets even bigger is to get in as many games as possible over the next, say, 3 to 4 weeks, then potentially take a period of leave or postponement of time, and then reconvene after a period of time as well. What they also have done is taken measures around games where they've reduced the timing around games from 20 minutes per quarter per time onto around 16, and they're allowed an extended bench as well, so there's more sort of interchange players allowed on and off as well. So they have put measures in, because traditionally it's you play every Saturday or Sunday in AFL, like one game a week for 22 rounds straight. What the players have said is they're willing to play up to two games a week if needs be, and hence why they brought in reduced time and more numbers on the bench as well.
Nicholas, just before we let you go, I mentioned at the top you're working in mental health as part of your role with the AFL Coaches Association, I understand. What challenges is that going to pose for you over the next couple of weeks? Have you already started to formulate in your head some of the advice you'll be giving? Because it's a challenging time for people once lockdown happens, and especially for athletes who rely on activity so much as part of their day-to-day life.
Yeah, definitely. And if you look at the strand of the AFL, there's 18 professional teams. There's 3,500 community AFL clubs in Australia. They feed into one of those 18 teams, so there is an aligned link back to them. And what our program does is essentially service those community coaches. There's around 50 to 60,000 community coaches in Australia. Basically, what we've built is a mental health program to help coaches understand, recognize, and manage signs of mental health. And what we're doing over this next period of time, so essentially what the AFL have done, in they brought in a community policy to say that all playing of games at community level is banned until or postponed until the 31st of May. No workshops, no face-to-face events, no coaching clinics, no games, nothing like that, because they can't control the masses in the community setting. So they've basically put a total ban on it. So what we've offered the state leagues and communities just of today, we had something like 15 of the local leagues online, and we were actually adopting our program from a face-to-face method to an online method, and we're going to bring all our courses online via Skype or Zoom and have educate our coaches at that time of self-isolation / boredom, maybe when they're sitting at home and not watching games or TV and wanting to educate themselves. So come hopefully when the season starts again for a community around June 1st, that they're, refreshed and ready to go, and they're in a good state mentally as well.
Yeah, and for any club GA player watching this, or for any sports person watching this, indeed, Nicholas, is there any advice you'd have for people, I guess, in any country around the world at the moment who've been struggling with this, who don't have their hobby to go to, who don't have their club training or whatever it is to go to on an evening?
Yeah, look, I'm not a psychologist, but I would recommend, social connection is a big thing, even though we're talking about social isolation at the moment. But don't be afraid to jump on a Skype or a Zoom or pick up the phone and have a real conversation. That's one of the big things. And, there's times where, it's going to be challenging. And on Tuesday, on Paddy's Day here, it was really challenging because I was told I couldn't deliver my program, over the next few months. And there's a lot of planning and stuff. And that's the sort of stuff I was struggling with. But with a good group of people and, good family and different thing around you, that, you can have conversations and you can move up and down that mental health continuum on any given day. So there's going to be periods where we're all struggling during this time. There's going to be a lot of stress and anxiety, but there's, there's heaps of podcasts, there's heaps of documents, there's heaps of videos that you can tap into through different online resources that you can get out there. So I'd recommend to anyone to, have a conversation, ask people how they're going and follow up with that on a daily basis.
Absolutely. Well, Nicholas Walsh, it's been great chatting to you. Thanks a million for taking the call.
No problem.
Nicholas Walsh,
thanks
there,
for having me on.
Live on the line from Australia. That game is 4 minutes old. I'm almost kind of tempted to give updates on the AFL at this point, but Jared, that doesn't sound like it's going to go on for too much longer, especially if they're starting to close borders to some extent. People can't come into the country and AFLW players are being sent home. This is a matter of games rather than a season here, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And it doesn't feel like these are the types of things that will go ahead once everybody realises what's happening. It's at the same time, right? What if they've found a way to continue games? What if there is a some template that evolves over a period of time? Like, it's very unlikely, right? But so I see John Fogarty on Twitter, and it's a perfectly valid point. AFL football operations manager Steve Hawking just told Australia's Channel 7 that he's at today's AFL opener to ensure people keep their distance before the start of a contact sport. The mind boggles. And Jack Anderson, friend of the show, has responded saying, no handshakes permitted before the game, but tackling during it. So, like, are all contact sports finished because there is a virus at large without a vaccine? Maybe. I mean, maybe. Maybe that's the future of the world that we live in that there won't be any contact sports. Like,
I think it's the immediate future.
Or everybody gets tested all the time. And I know there's a two-week lag, and I understand that you might be asymptomatic and you might have the virus. Maybe there's a point where we get to, as part of someone's job as a professional athlete, and this is exclusively for professionals, that you're tested every day for this. And if you're clear, away you go, and you go about your training and matches. And bear in mind, none of this matters, right? So just in case anybody's suddenly coming in and going, yeah, okay, fair enough. Obviously, everything else is far more important. But what if, like, there is a way to do this, and they're trying to find a way to do it? Like, if your job and the only thing you do is work in an industry that is now completely ruined because of this, then obviously you're going to try absolutely everything you possibly can to help your industry survive, because there are thousands of jobs and families and the mental health of those families at stake, because, like, we all need to go to work, and we all need to we all need our outlets. Like, and sport is a very important outlet, particularly in a time of global pandemic. So, like, look, I realize the obvious thing to do is to go, this is nonsensical, but, like, out of some nonsensical actions, we might learn some stuff.
Yeah, and I think
as long as it's not risking.
I think definitely as well in this part of the world, hopefully, fingers crossed, again, we don't know, but if there is a situation where we're at the peak, and even if that plateaus for a long, long time, at least if we almost know where we're at, where the peak is, you can almost start thinking about that sort of thing. It's still this state of unknowing about what will the peak be, when will the peak be, and that is obviously a question that Australia are wrestling with quite a bit at the moment. They are further away from that, certainly, than we are at the moment. But we're going to leave things there for this morning, Ger, in terms of our chat of coronavirus. What's your plan for the rest of the day? Is there a big birthday party to be had?
Oh no, we're going. Obviously, we're working from home. What do you mean? But hats off to the 4G. It worked much better than the wireless.
It's true. I'd actually completely forgotten about the 4G. You need to get onto your Wi-Fi provider, your unnamed Wi-Fi provider there, if your 4G is offering you such a good service.
I love all the Wi-Fi providers, Owen.
Yeah, I'm hearing an endorsement right there. Right, we are chatting Classic Game Club next. Ger, we'll leave you go. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. It is 8:48 on this Thursday morning. This is OTB AM. If you missed anything this morning, the full piece available on youtube.com/offtheball. The podcast will be up soon. We are going to Classic Game Club, as I say, because right after these, we're going back to the year 2000 when it was Celtic 6, Rangers 2.
Martin, without using words like sensational and unbelievable, can you describe that performance by Celtic?
I thought they played very, very well. Obviously got off a fantastic start. We're quick out of the blocks. Usual old phrase. Well, we were terrific throughout the match. Absolutely brilliant. We had to weather a storm at 3-1. Delighted to get the other goal, but the whole team were absolutely fantastic.
Who was your most important player today?
Oh, no, every single one of them. They were absolutely fantastic. G'd up for the game, they were ready for it, and they were powerful. The whole team was powerful.
How have you managed to turn a team?
No, we haven't. There's a long way to go. I genuinely mean this here. I'm delighted today. I'm delighted to have won the game. Players are couldn't possibly get carried away, because at the end of the day, Rangers are a top-class side. I mean it.
From the point of view that Celtic were not defending in all quarters last season, we saw examples that Chris Sutton coming back defending, Henrik Larsson. How have you managed to turn that round?
No, I say to you, I mean it. It's not turned round. We've played five games, only 33 more to go. We've got off to a decent start. The lads are full of confidence at this moment. But I tell you what, you know, I'm looking forward to them. They're coming back off international duty. And then we've got Raith Rovers and we've got Hibs to look at.
How did you manage to turn? What have you done for Bobby Petter? Because, and Chris Sutton as well, you spoke about confidence for him.
Confidence for Chris Sutton, I know him inside out. Bobby Petter, I don't know. Bobby Petter's done it all himself.
What about Henrik Larsson's performances? Does he get any? He seems to be getting better.
Absolutely world-class. World-class performance. Delighted for him. Delighted he's getting his fitness back. And you wouldn't believe it, I think there's some more to come from him.
Well, it's going to be an interesting season. Well done today, Martin.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks.
Martin O'Neill being Martin O'Neill there in the aftermath of Celtic 6, Rangers 2. The year was 2000. It was the very early days in that year's Scottish Premier League. We've got Endicott and Stephen Doyle with us on the line today because this is the Classic Game Club. We're going back to you, lads. I think probably your favourite sporting moment of all time, two Celtic fans here. Am I speaking out of turn there?
I would say so.
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty much up there. I suppose the occasion of the 2003 UEFA Cup final would probably be up there, but forgetting about the match itself. But yeah, no, I think, as Emma says there, it's definitely probably the big moment for Celtic fans.
For sure. Well, you get back into that Martin O'Neill interview in a little while. I don't think much has changed over the last 20 years in terms of O'Neill's personality and dealing with the media. As I said at the top, it is Celtic 6, Rangers 2. That is the score of the game. The demolition derby, as it's known. The context around this game for people coming to this fairly new. You can watch the full thing back on YouTube, by the way. It's August 2000, as I say, brand new season. Rangers, Scottish champions, 11 of the previous 12 years. It is utter domination. The blue side of Glasgow is flying at this moment. But, as you heard there, Martin O'Neill is a Celtic manager. It is his first season in the hot seat. And things have started pretty well for him. As you said, they are 5 games in. But this is the old firm. This is his first real test. Steve-O, we should just touch on this for a moment and end if you've got any memories as well. Around this time, it must have been incredibly tough to be a Celtic fan.
Yeah, definitely. Because, as you said there, you know, Rangers, they'd won 11 of the previous 12 titles. There was that, I suppose, a bit of a false dawn under Wim Jansen when he stopped the 10 in a row in the 97-98 season. That's probably one of the most important titles that Celtic ever won because, Celtic had obviously done the 9 in a row themselves, had been stopped doing the 10. And that is the magic number, as we know. Celtic are trying to achieve that again at the moment. But I think Wim Jansen stopping, that was really, it was crucial. But Rangers still won 11 of the previous 12 titles. They dominated the 90s. And then, of course, they were dominating the Old Firm Derby as well at that period because Celtic had lost 5, drawn 2 of the previous home meetings with Rangers. And they'd also, in the previous season, lost 3 times and drawn once against Rangers. And if you also, you might have heard O'Neill alluding to Henrik Larsson getting his fitness back. It was the year as well after Henrik Larsson had that horrific leg break. And nobody kind of knew at that stage how good Larsson, or if he could be as good as he had been for Celtic up till that point.
Yeah. Enda, do you have any memories of this? I presume it's hazy, if anything.
I'll be honest, this is more of a game that I remember from the folklore of it, really. So growing up in Donegal, obviously there's a big Celtic following. So this isn't a game I remember as a child because I was 4 and a half, maybe 5 at the time.
Yeah, you'd be doing well to remember that. So
this is more of a game that I remember from watching it back. And obviously we'll get to the goal, but Henrik Larsson's goal in this game, his first one in it, is probably the most famous Old Firm goal ever, I would say. But for context, we were talking about the context of this game. So if anybody wants to imagine what it was to be a Celtic fan right now, just ask the Rangers fans right now, because this is basically like Celtic winning the league next year and then Rangers beating them 6-2 in the following season. And we all know that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, it's important to point it out, Steve, like how outrageous the scoreline is. That, yeah, like Celtic going out and smashing somebody by 6 goals at this point is probably a rare occurrence, but to do it to Rangers at this point, completely unexpected. Like, where were you when you were watching this? Were you in a pub somewhere? Were you at home watching this? What was the story?
Yeah, well, like, I've been obviously over the parkhead and all that kind of thing, but at that stage, like, I hadn't been to an Old Firm. We used to go and watch I had a really good old friend of mine, John Flynn from Kildare. I'd moved down to Kildare at this stage. We used to go into Nace or else down to Kill, our local down in Kill, the old house, to watch the Celtic games. It's funny when you kind of think back to these things, how life has changed just even in Ireland at that stage. Because I asked a few people about it on Twitter last week. At that stage, the Holy Hour was still in operation on a Sunday. So between 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock, every Sunday afternoon, the pubs would close because of the Holy Hour, or the, I don't know why they didn't call it the Holy 2 Hours. But there, and what would happen was, see, all the big Scottish games were shown. It was either 12:30 or 1 o'clock kickoffs at that stage. So obviously the match would still be ongoing when the holy hour kicked in. So a lot of pubs would have to pull the blinds down, close the doors, and pretend that there was nothing going on, and hope that the guards wouldn't come along. I do actually remember one time, I won't mention which pub it was, but we were in one of these pubs that stayed serving during the Celtic game, and the guards did come in. We were all taken outside, and all our names taken in notebooks, and we're told, don't you be in the pub again in the holy hour, lads.
Jesus, you've got a criminal record, Stephen Doyle.
thankfully, he wasn't there. There was no charges involved. No. But yeah, I actually think what Enda says is actually a really good point in trying to contextualise what it would be like to achieve a result like that. And, you know, Rangers fans are in the situation now that Celtic fans were back then. And as you said, Owen, you know, to go out and to batter Celtic or batter Rangers with six goals scored was just incredible. And also, I suppose, to put into context, Celtic had gone through a couple of tough years because after Janssen left, after winning a title in 97-98, we had a couple of disastrous managerial reigns with Josip Venglos and also John Barnes as well. But I suppose it is crucial to remember as well that there were some important players brought in during that time, the likes of Henrik Tim Janssen, who was famous for £650,000, one of the greatest transfers in any football league. Also, you had Lubo Moravcik, who was brought in by Josip Venglos, and he was a crucial signing and played a big part in the start of the Martin O'Neill revolution at Parkhead. The other thing to remember, Owen, as well, is that while Rangers were spending big in the 90s, and, you know, it's emerged since that it wasn't all above board, but while they were spending big, Celtic weren't spending a lot of money, and they had a guy in charge of the club called Fergus McCann. And Fergus McCann got a lot of criticism at that time because he felt at the time it was better to invest money in the infrastructure of the club. So there was, like, you know, the extension of the capacity at Parkhead, which brought Celtic to up under 60,000 capacity, because he felt that the more bums and seats that you had, the more money that the club made, and the more money then you could reinvest in players and that kind of thing. But at the time, he got a lot of criticism from the support for what he was trying to do with the club. But since then, and Fergus McCann has been lauded, and rightly so, over the last couple of seasons, he's been brought back to Parkhead, and he's got a massively warm welcome back from the fans. But that'll give you an idea of what was going on at the time as well. Rangers were spending a lot of money. As we know, that season they spent, I think it was in the guts of 12 million, which was a lot of money at that time, people have to remember, on the three Dutch players, Kontermann, Rixon, and Ronald de Boer. Of course, later on that season, they bought Torre-André Flo for £12 million from Chelsea. But Celtic they started to open the coffers up a little bit. We know Chris Sutton, who I know we'll touch on a bit more, he was brought in for £6 million. And Mark Viduka obviously left Celtic. But there were a couple of more signings to come later down the road for Martin O'Neill, Alan Thompson, Didier Gatt, Brad Douglas, but they hadn't come in yet. But Chris Sutton was, I suppose, a big signing, will play a crucial role in that game, and the partnership with Henrik Larsson was going to become a big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go through these starting teams, though, for this Old Firm derby in August 2000. We'll start with Celtic, Jonathan Gould in goals, Yves Valgerin, Alan Stubbs, Stefan Mahy and Jackie McNamara, Bobby Petta as a fullback. I've got a feeling Bobby Petta is going to get a lot of mentions today. He was unbelievable in this game. Stylian Petrov, Paul Lambert, Lubo Moravcik, as you've mentioned, and then a front two, of course, of Henrik Larsson and Chris Sutton. The Rangers team then, Stefan Kloss in goals, you'd Fernando Rixon, as you've already mentioned, you'd Kontermann, Amoruso, Tony Vidmar, Claudio Reyna started this game, Barry Ferguson was in midfield with him, Giovanni Van Bronckhorst, Billy Dodds, Rod Wallace and Neil McCann. Then you look at the Rangers bench. Andriy Kanchelskis, two guy, Peter Lovenkranz, all come on and make appearances here. This is a deep Rangers squad. I think it speaks to what you're talking about there, Steve-O, in terms of the investment that Rangers have made. This is, on paper, an outstanding Rangers team, and clearly it was, with all the honours they won over previous seasons. I want to start, though, lads, talking about the broadcast of this game, because it's interesting. Oh. For anybody who's watched it on YouTube, it's fantastic. First of all, it's perfect that Jim White is presenting Scottish Premier League coverage. It's the only way it should be, and it's the only way it should ever be on Sky Sports. You've got the Sky Sports player cam, you've got the fan jewels, which is a classic feature, and then my favourite part of the broadcast is you've got this heavy trance track over Charlie Nicholas's analysis at halftime and full-time.
It's fantastic stuff. Just look at how young Jim White looks. And then Charlie Nicholas with a full head of black hair, doing the analysis afterwards. The camera work is fantastic. There's a Happy Mondays montage at the end with Happy Mondays playing in the background. And then you just have all the different graphics. The player zone or the player cam is one of my favorite ones because it was an entirely useless system that nobody ever used. You just followed a player around the pitch for 15 minutes. It was like, do you know the feature in FIFA now where you be a pro and you can choose to whether you can control the whole team or control your one player and you're just following him around the pitch the whole time? That's kind of like what it was, except it was real life and it was useless. But what's interesting about that, and one thing we might touch on later on, is Reyna's goal for Rangers that goes over the line. When they're analysing that at halftime, they only have one camera angle, so they've been wasting all these camera angles on the absolutely pointless player cam.
Good point.
When they genuinely couldn't see if the ball was over the line because they only had one camera angle on it.
Yeah, it's true. I didn't even think of that. What a waste. Like it's very, very unclear whether or not Reyna. I think it does go over the line, but there's really no way that they can make an educated guess at that in the studio. And Charlie Nicholas, I think he actually says, we're not sure, so it shouldn't have been given. It's quite the broadcast, Steve-O. It's the player cam. Were you a fan of that or not?
Well, to be honest, though, in the establishments we would have been drinking in, they didn't have that option to us. he introduced the match at the start saying, a Sky Sports production in widescreen with dull surround sound, Sky Interactive, alternative camera options, and a full stats service. Amazing.
What a breakthrough. What a season. A brand new century, a brand new hope for Scottish football. It's brilliant stuff. I would love to go back and actually watch the fan duels. I'm not sure were you familiar with this, that if you press the rent button, you can watch like fans actually commentating on the game. You can actually just forget the Sky Sports presenters and listen to some partisan commentary if that's what you wanted. Before we get into like certain categories and certain awards for this match, I want to just ask you, what level of heat was present in this game? How much needle, in your view, like relative to the Old Firm, did you think we got from this 6-2 match? Because I thought, not that it was toned down a little bit, I thought the atmosphere was amazing. I thought there were some very, very hard challenges. But we've definitely seen worse, haven't we? We've definitely seen testier affairs between these two teams.
Yeah, we definitely have. But one thing that I was going to point out in the context of this game, and one thing that's actually quite interesting watching it back, is how many Rangers fans are actually in the stadium, because that's changed in recent years. The last couple of years, Celtic and Rangers have been in this sort of weird battle with letting fans into the stadium. So there's only, I think Steve-O might have the actual number, but there's a very, very limited amount of Rangers fans allowed in Celtic Park and vice versa when it comes to the Old Firm. So it's very, very, it's kind of toned down when it comes to the atmosphere. It's not as heated as it used to be in this game. And that's probably one thing I noticed going into this game, that the atmosphere is really heated. But in terms of challenges, there were some really bad challenges in this game. I think one reason why the challenges these days might seem worse is because there's not one single good tackle in this match. The idea of tackling in this game is just kicking your man to the ground. There is no going for the ball. It's just pushing her over, shouldering the man, kneeing him down to the ground, whatever you can. So the tackles into the knees.
I actually disagree. Don't seem as bad. I disagree with that. In my notes, in fairness to these players, I have man and ball was fair game. Like, obviously, you're right. The number one aim was to murder your opposite man. That was number one aim of playing in this game. But in fairness, I think they tried to get the ball with the man as well. You're going to kill the man and puncture the ball or do whatever you need to do. But both were coming with you is the way I read this.
Yeah, well, you definitely had big men on the pitch as well. So that played a role in it. I mean, you had Amoruso and Majalvi as sort of the centre-back partnerships that were going up against each other, and they were absolutely huge. So if they are running into a small striker, then they're going to do damage regardless.
Hmm. There's one very early on. I can't remember who he gets. Billy Dodds goes in, and you're like, okay, this is the terms of engagement here, where he almost kills a man, and it's outrageous. There's one McCann versus McNamara at one stage. I think it's about 6 minutes into the game, where there's absolutely no booking because I think the referee just can't make up his mind as to who is actually the worst defender here. It's like you see a man, you're running at him head on, prepare to get your studs up, and just hope that your leg doesn't break in two. That's basically what the whole thing is.
I actually noticed that as well. It was Neil McCann. It was on Jackie McNamara 6 minutes in. Yeah, it was really early on. It was a horrible challenge. I think one of the goals from Celtic early on, it was the one that led to the corner. Bobby Petta rides like three or four really bad challenges as well, and the reason he stays up, and it actually works out in Celtic's favour. But yeah, it had some needle, but I would agree with you in your overall assessment that the recent derbies probably had a bit more needle in terms of bad challenges.
Well, yeah, I think that there is maybe the rule book was a little bit more flexible back in the time. If you're all of your studs happen to connect with somebody's shin, you might get away with it. You might get a yellow card or something like that. So I think people were allowed to express their violence within the rules a bit more, whereas nowadays, if you make one bad challenge, you're off the pitch and everything kind of escalates. Like, it is still remarkable, though, that it took 81 minutes for a red card in this game. Barry Ferguson obviously getting sent off for that one. One of the things that like struck me, I don't think it is evident through the television. I'm not sure, Steve, if you've spoken to anybody who's actually at the game, but I've got a sneaky suspicion that the television just doesn't do this atmosphere justice whatsoever. I've got a feeling it was absolutely feral in there, that like you had stuff being thrown at Giovanni Van Bronckhorst a few minutes later. That was at a corner. A few minutes later, he completely overhits a corner and almost goes out for a throw-in at the opposite end. And he's getting completely rattled by the fans here. That it was a true, I hate the cliche, but it was a true definition of a 12th man on this occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose you get a real sense of Celtic and the parquet atmosphere on those famous European nights. We all know Celtic are highly regarded, the supporters are highly regarded when it comes to their support for those big European nights. But those Saturday, Sunday afternoon games against Rangers, I've been there for big matches at once at Old Firm, and it really is hard to explain. Like, it's... The thing about it as well is that it doesn't come in waves. Like, it's just like an intense cauldron of atmosphere for the full 90 minutes. They just don't, they do not let up. As you say, on it, it's hard to actually get a real sense of it, watching it on the screen, watching it on television. You actually have to be there. And it is a great stadium. It's designed parquet, and that, it genuinely is like a cauldron the way it is designed. It doesn't go too far back. Everybody does. It feels like everybody's really on top of the players, on top of the pitch. And you're right. You know, you don't get a proper sense of it. And I'd even say, I think even the atmosphere, Enda might give you an opinion on this as well. I'd be interested to hear what he says. I think it might have changed even. Like, I don't know if it's as good now for those games as it was maybe back 15, 20 years ago.
Well, I was at probably the best atmosphere I was at a Champions League game in Celtic Park in 2008, and the atmosphere was electric. I think one thing that changed is they've changed around where the Green Brigade stand. So obviously they have the safe standing now, and that's the atmospheric stand. But that they used to be in the Lisbon Lions stand, which is directly behind the goal. So it was almost like if you want to imagine the Bernabeu, where you have the wave of white behind the goal. That's kind of where the Green Brigade were, and that's where I was for that match, and the atmosphere was absolutely incredible. And I would have probably agree with Steve's assessment is that in recent years, because all of the biggest fans that want to be in the singing section are isolated in that one stand, you don't get the same wraparound as you used to get, where all the fans are sort of spread out across the stadium.
Yeah, it seems to have changed a bit down through the years. Let's get into some of the awards throughout the game. We start with moment of the match here on Classic Game Club. I dare say that we're just going to get into a few goals here, really. I'm struggling to get into my head what actually is the moment of the match, but it's impossible to not pick Henrik Larsson's chip, right? Has anybody not gone for that, I think, is probably the way of framing this question. Go on, Steve-O, what have you gone for?
Yeah, one thing I'd say is, look, you know, it is seriously, I don't use the word lightly, it is an iconic moment in Scottish football, in Celtic's history, that Larsson goal. But the one thing, if you're going to look for a turning point, I think, in this game, because Martin O'Neill, you know, he said in his post-match press conference that they were under real pressure when the score went to 3-1. And they really had to battle hard to keep that score as it was going into the break at half-time. And I think the Rod Wallace goal that was ruled offside in the 42nd minute, and obviously when you look back at it, it was incorrectly offside, an incorrect offside call. I think if Rangers had got that goal, and if that had been 3-2 going into half time, you could have had a totally different second half, because Rangers are then coming out. Psychologically, it would have been huge for Rangers going in. You know, they're thinking, we were 3-0 down, now we're only 3-2 down. We still have 45 minutes to rescue this game here. And I think that was, if you're looking for a turning point in the game, I think that goal being called offside was massive. Really, really good.
We sometimes forget that Rangers had more shots in the first half. Like, this was not a 3-1 scoreline at all, really, was it? Was it deserved?
I think they were the better side once Celtic won 3-0 up. I thought the last 15, 20 minutes of that first half, Rangers were the better team. They created a lot of chances. They got the one goal. It should have been two. And I think Celtic were under real pressure for the last 15, 20, 20 minutes of the first half. Rangers definitely outplayed them.
Let's talk about this. Oh, sorry. Go on, Enda.
Sorry. I just wanted to say on that goal, we have to give a bit of appreciation towards Barry Ferguson's pass for that Rod Wallace goal. It was unbelievable. And it just shows you the quality that was in the SBL at that point in time. I would probably, if we're not going for the Larson's goal, I'd just like to chime in with mine. I was probably going to go for maybe Sutton's opening goal because so much rides on the first 10 minutes in Old Firms. Like, often the first goal can be the only goal in the game, and to score after 51 seconds to take that lead, especially in a game with such pressure, so a game the Celtic needed to get something out of so badly, to take the lead so early and then double it again, they really had a grip on the game really early. So that would have been a big moment in that game for me. It also was a big moment for Sutton as well, who Martin O'Neill alluded to after the game was struggling for confidence. Before the game started, what was interesting was the commentary. They said, after experience in the North London, East Anglian derbies, it's about time Chris Sutton stopped pussyfooting around and discovered what the real thing is about. And so this was his debut in an Old Firm, and people would have really had the opinion of him that he was just a big man with no skill. So for him to get the opening goal in this game would have been a massive moment.
What's the best part of Henrik Larsson's goal, the chip? Is it the nutmeg that he perhaps means to do? Is it the finish itself? Like, is it the fact that he almost sends the goalkeeper the wrong direction on two different planes? I just can't make my mind. Is it Chris Sutton being a fantastic man to hold up the ball, this beautiful combination of Route 1 football and the guile of Henrik Larsson? There are so many different facets to this. You could break this down and write a thesis on this goal. It is one of the best goals possibly ever scored in Scottish football. As you say, Steve-O, it's not doing the word iconic an injustice to describe this as such. It is possibly the most famous goal in recent times in the Old Firm. It's just perfect. It is just perfect.
I sent out a tweet there last week just saying we were prepping for this. And when I watched the stuff, like, you know, I've got a couple of big heroes in football. And Paul McGrath would be one. And Henrik Larsson is definitely another. Like, I was obsessed with that man. I was in love with that man. I could remember when, as a younger, I was only about 14, I think, when the 94 World Cup was on, and Henrik Larsson emerged in that World Cup with the Swedish team that got to the semi-final. And I just, you know, I was just struck by his dreadlocks, his movement, everything about him. He was perfect. And just when I started watching this game, and when they announced the teams, and they showed Larsson warming up before the game kicked off, and just to see that shot of him from behind, the number 7, Larsson on the back, the dreadlocks, and I was just like, I got a shiver. I was just, take me back to all those games when I watched him playing and how amazing he was. And I was just absolutely obsessed and in love with that man. And everything about that goal is just quintessential Henrik Larsson. Like, as you mentioned, there's the brilliant cushion header by Sutton from the Jonathan Gould kick out. Larsson, the first touch, it's almost like the ball was almost getting away from him. The second touch is amazing, where he retrieves it. Then, as you mentioned, the nutmeg, he absolutely makes a show of Counterman, which just added so much to it. And then to have the intelligence, the game intelligence. And then that trademark celebration is running out with the tongue sticking out. The brilliant Celtic ball boys behind the goal, jumping up and down, which is always a great thing.
Ball boys are amazing. Like, they hold nothing back.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's just brilliant.
It's, you don't want to overplay anything too much, but I wonder, lads, like, how responsible one individual can be for the allure of an entire league for a prolonged period of time. Because we're getting to know, like, I'm getting to know, my awareness of football is starting to grow as Henrik Larsson's influence at Celtic is starting to grow. And just the fascination you would have with the man as a kid, it's almost in hindsight kind of a little bit of a disbelief that he was at Celtic for so long that he was Celtic's thing. He was Glasgow Celtic's property for such a prolonged period of time that you had this sustained number of years of greatness coming from the striker. It almost felt like it should have been something that was happening at Barcelona or at Real Madrid, and yet this was happening in Glasgow within the last 20 years. I just feel that people around the world were tuning in to watch this guy, and by extension, he had just brought the entire league behind him, on his shoulders, without question, the best thing coming from this league. While the league was in an excellent place, let's not forget, at this time. I just think when it comes to one player, one man, has there been somebody as influential as him in Scottish club football in living memory?
Oh, can I just say, I'd like to get into his thoughts on it. Obviously, I don't want to dominate the conversation here, but just to remind people as well that Henrik Larsson, I've actually got a DVD at home, which is every single goal he scored in his career. He's such a fascinating study because Henrik Larsson almost gave up playing football. He obviously started off in Sweden, played for Högeberg, Helsingborg, then moved to Feyenoord in the Eredivisie. Now, when it came to the end of it, he didn't do too well at Feyenoord, and he was coming to the end of his time there, and he was almost going to go back to Sweden and pack in professional football. That's how bad it got for him. That was 1997, and Finn Jansen got word of this, and he thought, well, you know, I think I can get this guy's confidence back again. Larsson's confidence was on the floor at that time. He was ready to pack it all in, and then I said Finn Jansen came in and rescued him, signed him for £650,000. And the rest is history. But although maybe Enda can give you some, you know, fresh eyes in regards to his standing in Scottish football and world football.
Just on that, Steve-O, when you go through the DVD of Henrik Larsson, where does this goal rank?
It's his best. It's his best.
Is it?
Yeah. Like he scored some other brilliant goals. You might even say better quality. I would say, because there's so much to do with that. Like it's not just a case of having being at the goal, point, Kerr might say, there's a few touches involved, there's a lot of skill involved, and yeah, it's definitely his best.
And do you want to come in on that? What's it's obviously something that we look at from a very different point of view. I'm sure you're kind of in the same boat as me that I actually can't remember the first time I saw this. I can't remember if I was watching this game live, to be totally honest, but you know the goal, and it's something that we are all unbelievably familiar with. You just don't know when you were introduced to it or when it happened. It's just a part of life.
Yeah, well, I'd just like to reiterate kind of what Steve was saying. I was a massive Celtic and Henrik Larsson fan growing up, and even this goal is so iconic to me that in TY, when you do all the different projects or whatever, I actually painted a portrait of Henrik Larsson's celebration after this goal. I still have.
Where is this? We need to see this.
It looks nothing like him. The only thing that I got right were the dreadlocks and probably the background. But
and the jersey is pretty easy to draw as well.
The jersey, which we'll get to, is absolutely amazing as well. But yeah, Henrik Larsson, although the Scottish game was at a very strong stage at this point in time, I do want to hammer that home. Celtic were in a UEFA Cup final 2 years after this, and Rangers likewise a few years later. So the game was at a very strong stage in Scotland at this time, and he was by far and away the best player to play in it. He scored 53 goals in all competitions in this season. He scored 35 league goals that year. And like Steve-O, I don't have the DVD, but if you go onto YouTube, if you're bored, look up all of Henrik Larsson's goals for Celtic. The quality, the differences in the different skills. He had left foot, he had right foot. As you've seen from his second goal in this game, he could header the ball as well for a small man. He had a strong work ethic. And I think when you listen to different players, I know there's a lot of nonsense out there, but you can actually verify these through books. Some of the players who played with him later on in his career just spoke about the aura of playing with this legend of the game. And the fact that he, like you said, most of the time that he was a legend was the time at Celtic, but you hear Barcelona players who he was there for such a short time and he helped them win the Champions League. And then you hear Alex Ferguson. If Alex Ferguson has given you a bit of a paragraph in his book and it's all good, then you know you're doing something right. He wrote in his book about how when Henrik Larsson came in, that even the players who had won technically more than him because they had won Premier Leagues and they had won FA Cups, doubles, trebles, and they were looking at Henrik Larsson like, I can't believe I'm sitting in the dressing room with Henrik Larsson at the minute. that's the standing in the game that he had worldwide, not just in Scotland. So he's an absolute legend. He did an interview recently with Sky Sports, which is pretty interesting as well. He kind of details what Steve-O was saying about how he wasn't in a great place when he signed for Celtic, and Wyn Jansen actually had played a massive role in his career. Just bringing, he brought him to Feyenoord, and then he brought him with him to Celtic then after a few years when he heard he was available. So thank God for Wyn Jansen.
Absolutely. I think even if we reflected on this game and Henrik Larsson was never a part of Scottish football, we would still reflect on Scottish football as being in an incredibly good place at this time. But yet, despite that, we have Henrik Larsson so far ahead of everybody else in a very strong league at this time, which just shows the world-class talents he had. Well, like, before we get on to the secret man of the match, Larsson was the actual man of the match. Like, I'm just going to throw this out there. Is there a question between Henrik Larsson and Zlatan Ibrahimovic for you two in terms of the best Swedish striker we've seen in our lifetimes?
Oh, it's absolutely Henrik Larsson.
Just checking. Steve, I presume you go along with that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Larsson all the way.
Grant. Just double checking. I'm sure nobody would disagree with that. I'd be on your side there as well. Right, secret man of the match. As I say, Larsson is the actual man of the match. So I'm going to lead this one off and just say Bobby Petta. I think he was brilliant. I don't think it's too much of a left field suggestion. I think Charlie Nicholas brings him up afterwards saying, the co-coms actually bring it up and say that he should have probably been in with a shot of getting it, but Larsson's goal was just too good to ignore. Martin O'Neill has transformed this lad, is the line to give about Bobby Petta. So how much of an overperformance from Bobby Petta's baseline was this, Steve-O?
He was massively disappointing under John Barnes the previous season. That was a horrendous year for Celtic, and Bobby Petta was just, yeah, he was awful. He didn't really make any huge contributions. But O'Neill, whatever magic O'Neill was able to sprinkle across players back in those days when he had that ability to get inside players' heads, Martin O'Neill, it obviously worked on Bobby Petta. And it's worth remembering as well, you might have seen during the match footage, Louis van Gaal, who was the Dutch manager at that time, called Bobby Petta up. Unfortunately for Petta, he had a bad injury before he could actually get his first cap. But I have no doubt he probably would have become a Dutch international if it hadn't been for that injury.
Van Gaal is actually at this. He's at this Old Firm game, and he looks like Neo from The Matrix.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, those glasses, unbelievable. Lovely, that lovely cream suit as well. I was kind of thinking Paul Lambert might have got the secret man of the match, but obviously he went off injured in that game. Paul Lambert, I thought, he was kind of pulling all the strings in the centre midfield.
Absolutely.
And people have to remember as well, the Champions League winner, Paul Lambert, with Borussia Dortmund in 1997 as well, three years previously. He was a fantastic footballer. But yeah, I would say I'd agree with you on, I think Bobby Petta, secret man of the match. I think it's worth mentioning Luba Mravčić as well. Mm. I thought he was excellent, but I'd agree with you, Bobby Petta.
Well, just on Paul Lambert, I think it's a fantastic shout. I think he was due to become secret man of the match had he lasted again. I just love the way how he basically gets killed, is on the stretcher, and it's like, God, here, I'm looking at him like, God, does Paul Lambert play football again after this moment? Like, how long more does his career go on? And then he's like back up and scores a goal afterwards. And then, of course, he's back and he's dead again and stretchered off. It looked like an absolutely horrific injury. I don't know how he managed to get it back on the pitch. And like, I kind of spotted that as well. He's like,
you have to remember, I think around that time, they brought in the rule where no matter what the injury was, you had to get taken off in a stretch. And I think it was just to hurry on players who might have been trying to feign injury, trying to run the clock down. As far as I can remember, I think that was around the time where they'd said that everybody has to come off in a stretcher just to keep the game moving quickly.
Mm. And who have you gone for here, secret man of the match?
I think Bobby Petta probably overall the better player on the pitch throughout the game. Like I think he had a role in three goals, if I'm counting correctly. Like Steve was saying, Luba Mravčić was also excellent. And I think one thing that Celtic fans will remember Lubo for is his dead balls, that he was a dead ball specialist. So you can see that from his corners. I think Chris Sutton definitely deserves a shout in this as well. It's his first Old Firm game. Yes, his first goal was a mile offside, But he played. He scored two goals in an Old Firm on his first Old Firm performance, and then he also set up a couple of goals, and he was a good presence up front for Celtic. So I think he is definitely in with a shout.
I was reading some of the CelticWiki.com, and they were saying Chris Sutton scored a goal in just 51 seconds, a record for fastest goal scored in a Celtic versus Rangers match. Despite Dick Advocaat's attempts to call the first goal offside, the video evidence proves otherwise. So I'm sorry, Enda, but the CelticWiki.com disagrees with you. They were saying it was a perfectly good goal, Chris Sutton.
In that case, I will take that back. But yeah, I think VAR would definitely have ruled this a goal.
Who was the best Rangers player on the pitch, Enda?
It's a tough one. I think Giovanni Van Bronckhorst was quite good. Neil McCann was decent enough as well. Despite conceding six goals, and bear with me on this, I actually thought Amoruso was quite good in centre of defence as well. Overall, I would say it's probably Van Bronckhorst because he played a pivotal role in midfield for them. And to be honest, he's probably their best player in that squad as well.
Was Dick Advocaat a good Rangers manager, Steve-O?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I know there would have been obviously the Dutch influence there. He obviously, you see, the thing about Dick Advocaat was he would have had that the influence he had to sign all these big Dutch players to bring them in. I'm trying to remember now how many titles he won with Rangers. I think it was two Premier League titles and two Scottish Cups. So, I mean, it was two doubles in the previous 2 years. But then I think he moved on. I can't remember now actually where he moved on to following that. But, most definitely, he had them playing fantastic football.
He was on to the Netherlands after that then.
So, yeah, it was the Dutch. Yeah. So, absolutely, he was a successful manager, won two doubles with Rangers. They were a very good footballing side, and of course, actually, I think Barry Ferguson deserves a nod there as well. When you're kind of talking about I know Enda spoke about that brilliant pass he made for in the build up to the offside goal. But I thought overall Ferguson played really well. People, I suppose, only remember Barry Ferguson. A lot of people might only remember him from his time down at Blackburn Rovers, which wasn't great, but. He was a super player, and I think Dick Advocaat was a great coach for Barry Ferguson in helping him get to a pretty high level in his career.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Barry Ferguson was the first player that I actually genuinely hated. That's how good he was. I think the skinhead look, which was probably a little bit before his time. I know David Beckham had a skinhead a couple of years later, but Barry Ferguson, genuinely, I had a despise for him that was, it still probably hasn't been matched. Mm. And I suppose there's a little bit of admiration in that hatred.
Yeah, and fear, I'd imagine. The original skinhead, I think it's fair to say, it suited him down to the ground. What do we think of his red card? Was it a bit harsh?
Well, out of all the challenges in the game, then, I know it's a deliberate handball, and he actually did that a couple of minutes beforehand as well, so maybe that's why the referee decided to actually book him this time. I thought it was a bit harsh, but yeah, there was definitely some tackles that were more deserving of a red card. There was one on Bobby Petta in the second half that was just a studs into the knee challenge, and he was down for a while. I think it was Neil McCann that put that challenge in, but that was a dreadful challenge. There was also one on Van Bronckhorst from Jackie McNamara down the left wing that was on a horrific challenge as well. Van Bronckhorst was off the pitch for a good while after that.
Right, go on.
Yeah, just it's where I think Ferguson, that second yellow card, I think it was more so, I think he might have given the referee some abuse. So I think the ref just lost pace with him, whipped out the yellow card. But it's just interesting to note as well, Barry Ferguson, who I was trying to work out, he's born in 78, so he was 21, 22 when that match took place. And he took all that anger and he bottled it up and he let it out that evening because Barry Ferguson was actually arrested on the night of that game. I don't know if you're aware of that.
No, go on. What happened?
I'm just reading the BBC News report from that Monday, the 28th of August, 2000. Police have confirmed that Rangers star Barry Ferguson was injured during a street brawl after his team's 6-2 drubbing at the hands of Old Firm rival Celtic. A Strathclyde police spokeswoman said the 22-year-old, who was sent off during the Sunday derby, suffered an eye injury during the fracas. In all, 62 arrests were made and two incidents of violence followed, the high scoring match at Celtic Park in the east end of Glasgow. 14 were arrested at the game and a further 48 afterwards. In the main, they were charged with minor disorder offences and a number were expected to appear in court on Monday. I'd imagine that courtroom was a pretty entertaining place to be that Monday.
That night looked like it was a pretty good night in Glasgow. If you look at the Daily Record newspaper the next morning, there is a headline, and I'm sure people who were watching the game will have spotted Noel Gallagher at the Old Firm. Headline the next morning from the Daily Record, drugs raid on Liam Hotel. Police were called to a party attended by Oasis frontman Liam Gallagher yesterday after drugs complaints. They turned up at the Glasgow's Malmaison Hotel after staff claimed that revelers were taking drugs. The incident occurred in the hotel's brasserie bar where band members and their friends were partying after the festival in the city. It is understood that several guests complained about the smell of marijuana at the bar, and another guest claimed to have spotted signs of drug use. Liam Gallagher and Scots-born Primal Scream singer Bobby Gillespie had been among those partying in the bar, but neither were linked to the incident, of course, and Gallagher had left to return to the hotel where he was staying, the Devonshire. So it was a good night for the Gallaghers as well in Glasgow that night. So plenty happening, I think it's fair to say.
Yes. Glasgow was the place to be that night, I think.
Clearly was. What a night. We missed out on that one. Let's move on to trending. So we go through the trends that were noticeable at the time. I'm just going to leave this one off with direct football. Like, there was clearly a preponderance of great talent within the Celtic team. They could have played any way they wanted, maybe. But sometimes the way the football was going at that moment, it was just better to just lump it forward and see what way it breaks. And that's what happened with Henrik Larsson's chip goal. It came from route one ball right on top of the head of Chris Sutton. So that's one of the things that I noticed. Not as much working through the channels as you might be used to now. I'm not sure what you guys have spotted.
Yeah, well, that was probably one of mine as well. It's just the big man, little man up front that used to be a thing back then where you had the likes of Chris Sutton up front to head the ball down, sort of like what a Giroud does, because Chris Sutton, I definitely don't want to put him into the bracket of just a big man that was no good with his feet, because he was actually very good with his feet. But at that stage, he was definitely utilised for his height and his strength, and getting Henrik Larsson on the ball as much as he possibly could. I think every single time that Gould caught the ball or got the ball into his hands, first thing it wasn't even when the game got into the dying embers, it wasn't like sit on the ball and waste time. It was get the ball into the opposition half as quick as possible.
Yeah. What about you, Steve? What have you got?
When you go with trending, like I suppose the player cam thing was for me was that it's, you know, it was kind of, I don't know if you're talking about maybe the style of the way the players were playing at the time. The back three, I suppose, another interesting. Martin O'Neill had brought from his time at Leicester City as well. But I suppose I'd probably go with him as well, just the whole two striker thing really, which is gone now, isn't it? Like, we don't see any kind of big man partnerships in football anymore. And yeah, I'll take that one.
Well, what about the jerseys, lads?
Yeah, I had a couple of things noted as well, apart from the style of the play, just the style of the jerseys and just generally how cool the players look. If you like Stylian Petrov, for me, is that era's, say, Xabi Alonso, where everyone's just like, oh, he just looks so cool when he's on the ball. The fact that they're all wearing, well, the footballers, so the likes of Stylian Petrov, Van Bronckhorst, are wearing the Predator Manias that Zidane made famous 2 years earlier. The NTL Celtic jersey is probably the best Celtic jersey in recent memory. The Rangers one was horrible. If you notice, this is the stage where Celtic and Rangers both had the same sponsorships, but Nike made the Rangers jerseys and Umbro made the Celtic jerseys. And that used to be a big sort of, when Rangers were dominating, that used to be a big sort of pole to poke Celtic fans with, that you're only made by Umbro, so therefore we're better. We're made by Nike, the global, the bigger brand wants to sponsor our jerseys, so therefore we're the better side. And to an extent, that's happening now with Celtic, where Celtic are made by New Balance, and the Hummel jerseys for Rangers were made an absolute laughing stock last year, because Celtic fans couldn't believe how far Rangers had fallen, the fact that they had to get Hummel to sponsor their jerseys.
I have to say, I like Hummel are fantastic, making myself a few of their jackets home. Actually, jerseys as well. Billy Dodds was a bit like Billy Dodds and Neil McCann, I thought, on Rangers side. They were like Michael Owen. They like the jerseys were about three times too big for them. They look ridiculous. Like they actually look like young, you know, maybe under 12s footballers playing on a pitch with a lot of senior men. It was crazy.
Could I just ask, Enda, have you ever thought that a Rangers jersey? Have you ever looked at it and be like, it's nice, fancy that?
No.
Like, I presume no. that you just hate all. I presume you would say that all the Rangers jerseys are crap.
They're all awful.
Genuinely, but the Hummel thing is real. Trust me on this, because there is even I like Hummel in general, but in terms of the fan zones and the Celtic Twitter pages, they were laughing at Rangers when they got Hummel. Also, it didn't help the fact that some of the Rangers players were wearing different, like the Hummel jerseys didn't match. So some of the badges were on different areas on the jerseys. So it's a real thing. Trust me on it.
Let's move on. Sorry, go on.
Bohemian shirts were made by Hummel for a fair few seasons, and they were fantastic.
Good brand, no, is what you're saying. Dependable.
Listen, I like Hummel. I genuinely, I think they make quite nice jerseys, except for when they're Rangers. But they did really make a huge error when they were making their Rangers jerseys, because they were all over the place in the first season.
Let's move on to most jarring, and it's kind of a fashion thing that jarred at me the most. Union Jack hoodies. Is this still a thing?
I can't remember seeing any, but I'm sure there definitely are. We're in Brexit era right now, so I would say there definitely is someone out there that is willing to wear a Union Jack hoodie.
Like, obviously, the Celtic fans have continued a good kind of tradition of sporting tricolours and things like that. Like, I just don't recall the Union Jack being as prevalent. I think every Rangers fan almost had a Union Jack hoodie on. But I think it might be more down to the fact, to the point you made earlier on, that there was just a bigger allocation of tickets for Rangers fans on this occasion. So maybe I was like, whoa, that's just kind of overwhelming when I saw it. But that's the only thing that really jarred with me. Like, outside of that, it's a game that's obviously of its time insofar as it features quite a lot of direct football. But I think outside of that, to be honest with you, lads, this is a game that actually kind of sits quite well, even with eyes from 2020 on it. Like, I don't think there's too much that you look at and you're like, oh, that's really weird, that's really unusual. There are obviously the little quirks that existed at the time, but it's nothing major. You don't really say, wow, that's been a long 20 years.
Yeah, maybe the online technology thing might be the
true
one, because as Enda spoke about earlier on, the fact that the rain ago, there just seemed to be only one angle, and it was a really poor one. And I don't know how Charlie Nicholas, in his halftime analysis, seemed pretty certain about that being a goal. I don't know how he could figure it out from the angle that he had, because it wasn't very clear. But I suppose that's the thing that you're kind of thinking nowadays, we wouldn't see that. We'd have a definitive call on that, because we've got goal line technology now as well. I don't know if this comes under the jarring headline on, but I think something maybe that just kind of hit me watching the game, which is, you know, I don't kind of make people too sad, but it was just the whole Fernando Rixon thing. And I think when he passed away last year, I think it was something that even, you know, whatever colour jersey you were wearing, both teams can give respect to players in those kind of times. Obviously, Fernando Rixon played as a fullback for Rangers for a couple of seasons. And look at him out there on that day in the prime of his life, absolutely playing brilliant stuff. And unfortunately, lost the battle with motor neuron disease last year, which is such a tragic way for a man like him to go. And I think it was just, I think it just hit me a little bit watching him in that game on the video. It doesn't matter what side of the fence you're on. I think everybody can give respect to a really great footballer like Fernando Rixon.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Like, on a similar vein as well, you obviously got Jackie McNamara in the peak of his health out there as well. Like, he was unbelievable in this game, and it's just, it is kind of weird, isn't it, when you watch a game like that. Obviously, with Rixon, it's a terrible situation, and the last time you hear that name before watching this game is probably in the headlines about him having passed away. And then similarly with McNamara having had his bleed in the brain so recently, you kind of hear these names and then you're immediately transported to watching these guys back in the pomp of their career and the peak of their health. It's a really good point. I never thought of that, but I guess it is kind of jarring, because naturally it is the first thing you think of. We are watching this in the year 2020. We can't pretend to just leave away what we now know when you're watching this game. So yeah, it's a good point. we should move on then to the reaction to the sliding doors, to the context here. Any final thoughts you might have? We almost started this whole thing with the reaction, the Martin O'Neill interview. I think I wanted to play it at the very top because it's just a brilliant piece of audio. It's Martin O'Neill being Martin O'Neill. And if we accept that it's okay for us to talk about this from the point of view of 2020, we should also talk about this from the point of view of watching this as Republic of Ireland fans and yeah. our own relationship with Martin O'Neill as football fans and how we always use it as a stick to beat him with, especially in the media, that, you know, he dealt with Tony O'Donoghue terribly and all that sort of thing. This is the way Martin O'Neill was. This is the way he's always been. He's never been different. Mm. He was always brash with reporters, even after winning a game 6-2. And kind of looking back at this, seeing him leap all over the sideline the way he did a couple of times with the Republic of Ireland as well. Like, I wonder, does it change your view at all, just reminding yourself of Martin O'Neill as a Celtic manager and how unbelievably successful he was with them?
I don't think it does for me, because I was able to separate the two, and it got to the stage where, like, you can definitely remember what he did with Celtic and also be critical of what he was doing at Ireland. You definitely have to separate the two, but definitely within Celtic circles there were people who were very, very, very loyal to Martin O'Neill for a long time in Ireland, simply down to the fact that they did not want to criticise him because he is a Celtic legend. He's Celtic go on to win the treble after this year. This is honestly the biggest year for Celtic in living memory for a lot of fans. This is the biggest moment, the biggest year for them, and for a man like Martin O'Neill to bring that, you're never going to be critical of him then later on in the year when he's starting to drift a little bit. But I think one thing that is probably a little bit jarring for this is just the fact that if you look at Martin O'Neill's career after this and the success he has with Celtic and the diversity of his teams and the way that they played, it's just such a bygone era, because he was able to have so much success and then he tried to replicate that 10 years later and the game had moved on so much that he just couldn't do it.
Yeah, definitely. I think, like, is that symptomatic of Martin O'Neill not evolving enough with time? I always think it's a very, very hard thing to suggest that a manager who has had a fair degree of success already in his career suddenly change with the times. I think if any of you or I were a football manager and we've had the success Martin O'Neill has had, to kind of rip up what has been done and move with the times is a much harder thing to do rather than just say. And perhaps he deserves a little more credit. I think that, you know, what we've left with Martin O'Neill as Republic of Ireland football fans is kind of a very different thing to just the Celtic-only fans and what their memories of O'Neill would have been.
It also explains a little bit of his behaviour, though, on when you think about it, because I know that some of his treatment with Tony O'Donoghue was a bit out of line, but when he was brazen and when he was angry at being questioned by journalists, it's because he has the success in his locker. He brought Celtic to a European Cup final, or a UEFA Cup final, sorry, and he has had the success, and basically probably had the thought, like, who are you to question me? I have had success in my previous years as manager, sort of like Jose Mourinho now. He clung to the past, but as a manager with a game that evolves so quickly, if you don't evolve, you die. And that's unfortunately what happened Martin O'Neill with Ireland. And I suppose if you look sort of a revisionist version of Martin O'Neill's career at Ireland, it was okay, it was decent enough, but at the end of the day, Ireland ended up in a very bad position because of his management. Not entirely because of down to his management, but he definitely played a role in it.
Yeah, I think as well it's important to remember that the players that O'Neill signed when he got to Celtic, and if you look at all the players that he signed, you know, people, I suppose, would have questioned Martin O'Neill managing the Republic of Ireland. And there was the constant, I suppose, analysis over his game plans and the fact that the game plans were actually quite limited, that he didn't really give players too much instruction before they went out. But that was perfect at Celtic, because if you look at the players that he had and the players that he signed, there was a lot of big characters in that Celtic dressing room, like the likes of Larson, the likes of Chris Sutton, the likes of Neil Lennon that came in that December. Trying to think back now.
Alan Thompson, centre midfield, came in. He was a massive character.
So a lot of those players were very strong characters in their own right. I would say Martin O'Neill didn't have to give them an awful lot of instruction before they went down onto the pitch. So I think that that's why it worked at Celtic. That's why it worked at Leicester City, and the same at Aston Villa, when you had that bit of success there, getting them pretty high up the Premier League table at a time when other teams had a lot more money and were dominating. But regards, if you go back to the, I suppose, the sliding doors point, you know, Rangers have dominated for so long. Celtic had a couple of false starts made under Billy McNeil, Vin Janssen. Some managers were there. It didn't work out for them. There came a time, I suppose, when people also maybe looked down their nose at Martin O'Neill's achievements in Scotland, because they just thought, well, it's only Scottish football. Well, if it was that easy, there would have been other managers that would have went there and had the same success. What Martin O'Neill achieved at Celtic was incredible. I think you will, you know, I suppose I worked as a journalist covering the Republic of Ireland when Martin O'Neill was in charge. And it was hard because that man was a bit of a hero to me when I was a Celtic supporter. And I loved what he did. I had a huge admiration for what he did. I wasn't really a huge admirer of what he did with the Republic of Ireland. And it was hard to, I suppose, to separate that, which you do have to when you're working as a journalist. But, you know, I think he should always be remembered as a legend at Celtic, because he achieved great things. He won so many trophies. And it was because he was a good manager. It was because he signed good players. And it was because he got that team playing really good football. They went on after that game. They obviously got beaten by Rangers in November derby, 5-1. I think that's a bit of an outlier in the grand scheme of things. From that result, basically, it was the end of Rangers. You know, we know what's happened since then with the club. Obviously, going into administration, that kind of thing. But for Celtic, they went on, won three titles in the next four seasons under O'Neill. Henrik Larsson was the top scorer in all four of those seasons. Larsson going on to win the Golden Boot, of course, that season as well. You know, he turned around Chris Sutton's career as well. Chris Sutton, after having brilliant spells with Norwich City and Blackburn, he had that failure with Chelsea, and O'Neill signed him for Celtic and absolutely turned his career around. I think something Chris Sutton will always thank Martin O'Neill for. So it definitely was a sliding doors moment, I think, and a turning point for the club.
Last question then, lads. Is this game over or underrated? I'm going to start off by saying it's underrated. I had kind of forgotten about the game until you lads suggested it, and watching it back is marvellous. It's, I don't think we give this era of Scottish football actually enough credit, to be honest. I think that, as we've already mentioned, it can often be reviewed as the Henrik Larsson show, but the quality here is brilliant. I think that if you kind of break it down and talk about the style of football as being quite direct or whatever, I don't think that's a fair point about Scottish football at the time, because I think that was football at the time. I think if you watch any Premier League game from that era, the quality isn't going to be a million miles different. Of course, Premier League is a higher quality, but at its peak, the Old Firm derby would be able to give it a bit of a match. I thought it was fantastic. I think it's underrated. I think there are so many different storylines going into the game, so many different storylines, as you've outlined there, Steve-O, coming out of the game, and then just some sparklings of gold dust throughout. Henrik Larsson in particular, absolutely underrated for me.
Yeah, I agree with... Sorry, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, no, look, I'll be short and sweet. I think it's actually really good or interesting that you've said that, because I think maybe for myself, who was immersed in the whole kind of green and white thing back then, it's hard to, I suppose, maybe give a more kind of arm's length view of it. But I think what you said there, Owen, is pretty spot on. The quality of football being played in that game was absolutely fantastic. Some brilliant moments. I suppose it's probably more of an enjoyable game for Celtic fans to watch back on. Maybe not so much for the Rangers fans, but I think anybody neutral, if they go back and watch that game in full, I think they'll really enjoy it the same way as you have, Owen. I think you're spot on. It's definitely underrated.
And
I completely agree. Before I actually watched the whole thing back, the highlights don't actually show every goal in the game, so you forget that Rangers scored a second goal at all in the first half, and you just forget about some of the tackles, some of the play that was in it. So yeah, I completely agree. I think this is an underrated game. You're looking at some of the players, maybe not at their peak at the time, but getting there. So you have the likes of Larsson, who this was his sliding doors moment. This is when he becomes a global superstar. You have Chris Sutton getting his career back together after Chelsea. Stylian Petrov, we all know what he did to the Premier League. When he went to the Premier League, he was still as classy as he was out in this pitch. So there's some quality football on show. And it's just... start to finish, it's an entertaining game, including Jim White, who can I mention, was quite scary when he was young looking. he was still grey, and he still had his voice, so it's still the same person, but he just has a baby face, so he looks the exact same, but just with a baby face. It's actually a little bit uncomfortable.
I think we might leave it there on Jim White's scary. Is it kind of like Chucky kind of scary, is it, or what sort of thing?
It's kind of like, it looks like what if Jim White got Botox now and then sat in a sunbed for too long. That's kind of what he looks like.
That is quite the image. Terrifying, if we didn't need any more terror in our lives right now. And listen, and then Steve-O, thanks a million for joining me on this journey, for watching it back. I would highly recommend it for anybody sitting at home with nothing to do over the next few days. Just give it a Google there, Celtic Rangers 2000. This has been the Classic Game Club. We're very open to any of your suggestions. You can tweet any of us individually or tweet at Off The Ball if you've got any suggestions for stuff for us to go back and watch. We've got all the time in the world to watch it back over the next few weeks, unfortunately. We'll chat to you next time. Good luck for now.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.